Yes, boss. I just wanted you to know that this is my final mission, and I couldn't have hoped for a finer companion. He reached out and gave Freddy's shoulder a squeeze. Beside Freddy, Perlmutter snored with his Ma-Joed face tipped up toward the roof. 5 minutes or so before reaching the stone pillars, he had passed several long, spectacularly odoriferous farts. After that, Pearlie's distended gut had gone down again. Probably for the last time, Kurtz thought. Freddy's eyes, meanwhile, had grown gratifyingly bright. Kurtz was delighted. He had not entirely lost his touch, even now, it seemed.
All right, Buck, Kurtz said. Full speed ahead and damn the torpedoes, right?
Right, sir.
The entity, which now thought of itself as Mr. Gray, who thought of himself as Mr. Gray, had a serious problem, but at least he knew it. Forewarned is forearmed, is how Jonesy put it. There were hundreds of such sayings in Jonesy's storage cartons, perhaps thousands. Some of them Mr. Gray found utterly incomprehensible. A nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse was one such. What goes around comes around was another. But forewarned is forearmed was a good one. His problem could be best summed up with how he felt about Jonesy. And, of course, that he felt at all was bad enough. He could think, now Jonesy is cut off, and I have solved my problem. I have quarantined him just as their military tried to quarantine us. I am being followed, chased in fact, but barring engine trouble or a flat tire, neither group of followers has much chance of catching me. I have too great a lead. These things were facts, truth, but they had no savor. What had savor was the idea of going to the door behind which his reluctant host was imprisoned and yelling, I fixed you, didn't I? I fixed your little red wagon, didn't I? What a wagon, red or otherwise, had to do with any of this, Mr. Gray didn't know. But it was an emotional bullet of fairly high caliber from Jonesy's armory. It had a deep and satisfying childhood resonance. And then he would stick Jonesy's tongue. My tongue now, Mr. Gray thought with undeniable satisfaction, between Jonesy's lips, and give him the old raspberry. As for the followers, he wanted to drop Jonesy's pants and show them Jonesy's buttocks. This was as senseless as what goes around comes around, as senseless as Little Red Wagon, but he wanted to do it. It was called mooning the assholes, and he wanted to do it. He was, Mr. Gray realized, infected with this world's virus. It began with emotion, progressed to sensory awareness, the taste of food, the undeniable savage pleasure of making the state trooper beat his head in against the tiled bathroom wall, the hollow thud thud of it, and then progressed to what Jonesy called higher thinking. This was a joke in Mr. Gray's view, not much different from calling shit reprocessed food or genocide ethnic cleansing. And yet, thinking had its attractions for a being which had always existed as part of a vegetative mind, a sort of highly intelligent not-consciousness. Before Mr. Gray had shut him up, Jonesy had suggested that he give over his mission and simply enjoy being human. Now he discovered that desire in himself, as his previously harmonious mind, his not-conscious mind, began to fragment, to turn into a crowd of opposing voices, some wanting A, some wanting B, some wanting Q squared and divided by Z. He would have thought such babble would be horrible, the stuff of madness. Instead, he found himself enjoying the wrangle. There was bacon. There was sex with Carla, which Jonesy's mind identified as a superlatively enjoyable act, involving both sensory and emotional input. There was fast driving and bumper pool in O'Leary's bar near Fenway Park, and beer, and live bands that played loud, and Patti Loveless singing Blame It on Your Lying, Cheating, Cold, Dead, Beaten, Two-Timing, Double-Dealing, Mean, Mistreating, Loving Heart, whatever that meant. There was the look of the land rising from the fog on a summer morning. And murder, of course. There was that. His problem was that if he didn't finish this business quickly, he might never finish it at all. He was no longer Byram, but Mr. Gray. How long before he left Mr. Gray behind and became Jonesy? It's not going to happen, he thought. He pressed the accelerator down, and although it didn't have much, the Subaru gave him a little more. In the back seat, the dog yipped, then howled in pain. Mr. Gray sent out his mind and touched the Byram growing inside the dog. It was growing fast, almost too fast. And here was something else. There was no pleasure in meeting its mind. None of the warmth that comes when like encounters like. The mind of the Byram felt cold. Rancid. Alien, he muttered. Nevertheless, he quieted it. When the dog went into the water supply, the Byram should still be inside. It would need time to adapt. The dog would drown, but the Byram would live yet a while, feeding on the dog's dead body until it was time. But first, he had to get there. It wouldn't be long now. As he drove west on I-90, past little towns, shit splats, Jonesy thought of them, but not without affection, like Westboro, Grafton, and Dorothy Pond, getting closer now, maybe 40 miles to go, he looked for a place to put his new and uneasy consciousness where it wouldn't get him in trouble. He tried Jonesy's kids, then backed away, far too emotional. Tried Duddits again, but that was still a blank. Jonesy had stolen the memories. Finally, he settled on Jonesy's work, which was teaching history, and his specialty, which was gruesomely fascinating. Between 1860 and 1865, it seemed, America had split in two, as virus colonies did near the end of each growth cycle. There had been all sorts of causes, the chief of which had to do with slavery. But again, this was like calling shit or vomit reprocessed food. Slavery meant nothing. Right of secession meant nothing. Preserving the Union meant nothing. Basically, they had just done what these creatures did best. They got mad, which was really the same thing as going mad, but more socially acceptable. Oh, but on such a scale. Mr. Gray was investigating boxes and boxes of fascinating weaponry. Grape shot, chain shot, mini balls, cannon balls, bayonets, landmines, when a voice intruded. Bacon. He pushed the thought aside, although Jonesy's stomach gurgled. He'd like some bacon, yes. Bacon was fleshy and greasy and slippery and satisfying in a primitive physical way, but this was not the time. Perhaps after he'd gotten rid of the dog. Then, if he had time before the others caught up, he could eat himself to death if he so chose. But this was not the time. As he passed exit 10, only two to go now, he turned his mind back to the Civil War, to blue men and gray men running through the smoke, screaming and stabbing each other in the guts, fixing little red wagons without number, pounding the stocks of their rifles into the skulls of their enemies, producing those intoxicating thud, thud sounds, and bacon. His stomach gurgled again. Saliva squirted into Jonesy's mouth, and he remembered Dysart's. The brown and crispy strips on the blue plate, you picked it up with your fingers. The texture was hard, the texture of dead and tasty flesh. Can't think of this. A horn honked irritably, making Mr. Gray jump, making Lad whine. He had wandered into the wrong lane, what Jonesy's mind identified as the passing lane, and he pulled over to let one of the big trucks, going faster than the Subaru could go, sweep by. It splashed the small car's windshield with muddy water, momentarily blinding him, and Mr. Gray thought, "Catch you, kill you, beat the brains out of your head, you unsafe Johnny Reb of a driver, you thud, thud, fix your wagon, your little red bacon sandwich." That one was like a gunshot in his head. He fought it, but the strength of it was something entirely new. Could that be Jonesy? Surely not. Jonesy wasn't that strong. But suddenly he seemed all stomach, and the stomach was hollow, hurting, craving. Surely he could stop long enough to assuage it. If he didn't, he was apt to drive right off the bacon sandwich with mayo. Mr. Gray let out an inarticulate cry, unaware that he'd begun to drool helplessly. "I hear him," Henry said suddenly. He put his fists to his temples as if to contain a headache. Christ, it hurts. He's so hungry. Who? Owen asked. They had just crossed the state line into Massachusetts. In front of the car, the rain fell in silver wind-slanted lines. The dog? Jonesy? Who? Him, Henry said. Mr. Gray. He looked at Owen, a sudden wild hope in his eye. I think he's pulling over. I think he's stopping. Boss. Kurtz was on the verge of dozing again when Perlmutter turned, not without effort, and spoke to him. They had just gone through the New Hampshire tolls, Freddie Johnson being careful to use the automated exact change lane. He was afraid a human toll taker might notice the stench in the Humvee's cabin. Kurtz looked into Archie Perlmutter's sweat-streaked, haggard face with interest, with fascination even. The colorless, bean-counting bureaucrat, he of the briefcase on station and clipboard in the field, hair always neatly combed and parted ruler straight on the left, the man who could not for the life of him train himself out of using the word sir, that man was gone. Thin though it was, he thought Pearlie's countenance had somehow richened. He's turning into Ma Jode, Kurtz thought, and almost giggled. Boss, I'm still thirsty. Pearlie cast longing eyes on Kurtz's Pepsi, then blew out another hideous fart. Ma Jode on trumpet in hell, Kurtz thought, and this time he did giggle. Freddy cursed, but not with his former shocked disgust. Now he sounded resigned, almost bored. I'm afraid this is mine, Buck, Kurtz said, and I'm a wee parched myself. Perlmutter began to speak, then winced as a fresh pain struck him. He farted again, the sound thinner this time, not a trumpet, but an untalented child blowing over a piccolo. His eyes narrowed, became crafty. Give me a drink, and I'll tell you something you want to know. A pause. Something you need to know. Kurtz considered. Rain slapped the side of the car and came in through the busted window. The goddamn window was a pain in the ass, praise Jesus. The arm of his jacket was soaked right through, but he would have to bear up. Who was responsible, after all? You are, Pearlie said, and Kurtz jumped. The mind-reading thing was just so spooky. You thought you were getting used to it, and then realized that no, negative, you were not. You're responsible. So give me a fucking drink. Boss? Watch your mouth, cheese boy, Freddy rumbled. Tell me what you know, and you can have the rest of this. Kurtz raised the Pepsi bottle, waggling it in front of Pearlie's tortured gaze. Kurtz was not without humorous self-loathing as he did this. Once he had commanded whole units and had used them to alter entire geopolitical landscapes. Now, his command was two men and a soft drink. He had fallen low. Pride had brought him low, praise God. He had the pride of Satan, and if it was a fault, it was a hard one to give up. Pride was the belt you could use to hold up your pants even after your pants were gone. Do you promise? Pearlie's red, fuzzed tongue came out and licked at his parched lips. If I'm lying, I'm dying, Kurtz said solemnly. Hell, Buck, read my fucking mind. Pearlie studied him for a moment, and Kurtz could almost feel the man's creepy little fingers, mats of red stuff now growing under each nail in his head. An awful sensation, but he bore it. At last, Perlmutter seemed satisfied. He nodded. I'm getting more now, he said. And then his voice lowered to a confidential, horrified whisper. It's eating me, you know. It's eating my guts. I can feel it. Kurtz patted him on the arm. Just now they were passing a sign which read, Welcome to Massachusetts. I'm going to take care of you, laddie buck. I promised, didn't I? Meantime, tell me what you're getting. Mr. Gray is stopping. He's hungry. Kurtz had left his hand on Perlmutter's arm. Now he tightened his grip, turning his fingernails into talons. Where? Close to where he's going. It's a store. In a chanting, childish voice that made Kurtz's skin crawl, Archie Perlmutter said, "Best bait, why wait? Best bait, why wait?" Then, resuming a more normal tone, "Jonesy knows Henry and Owen and Duddits are coming. That's why he made Mr. Gray stop." The idea of Owen catching Jonesy, Mr. Gray, filled Kurtz with panic. "Archie, listen to me carefully."
"I'm thirsty," Perlmutter whined. "I'm thirsty, you son of a bitch!"
Kurtz held the Pepsi bottle up in front of Perlmutter's eyes, then slapped away Perlmutter's hand when Pearlie reached for it. "Do Henry, Owen, and Dud Dutz know Jonesy and Mr. Gray have stopped?"
"Dud Dutz, you old fool," Perlmutter snarled,
then groaned with pain and clutched at his stomach, which was on the rise again.
"Dutz! Dutz! Dud Dutz! Yes, they know. Duddits helped make Mr. Gray hungry. He and Jonesy did it together."
"I don't like this," Freddy said.
"Join the club," Kurtz thought.
"Please, boss," Pearlie said. "I'm so thirsty."
Kurtz gave him the bottle, watched with a jaundiced eye as Perlmutter drained it.
$4.95, boss," Freddy announced. "What do I do?"
"Take it," Perlmutter said. "Then 90 West.
He burped. It was loud, but blessedly odorless.
"It wants another Pepsi. It likes the sugar. Also the caffeine."
Kurtz pondered. Owen knew their quarry had stopped, at least temporarily. Now Owen and Henry would sprint, trying to make up as much of that 90 to 100-minute lag as they could. Consequently, they must sprint as well. Any cops who got in their way would have to die, God bless them. One way or the other, this was coming to a head. "Freddy,
boss,
pedal to the metal. Make this bitch strut, God love you. Make her strut." Freddy Johnson did as ordered. There was no barn, no corral, no paddock, and instead of out-of-state LICs, the sign in the window showed a photograph of the Quabbin Reservoir over the legend, "Best bait, why wait?" But otherwise, the little store could have been Goslin's all over again. Same ratty siding, same mud-brown shingles, same crooked chimney dribbling smoke into the rainy sky, same rusty gas pump out front. Another sign leaned against the pump, this one reading, "No gas. Blame the ragheads." On that early afternoon in November, the store was empty save for the proprietor, a gentleman named Deke McCaskill. Like most other folks, he had spent the morning glued to the TV. All the coverage, repetitive stuff for the most part, and with that part of the North Woods cordoned off, no good pictures of anything but Army, Navy, and Air Force hardware, had led up to the president's speech. Deke called the president Mr. Okefenokee on account of the fucked up way he'd been elected. Couldn't anybody down there fucking count? Although he had not exercised his own option to vote since the Gipper, now there had been a president, Deke hated President Okefenokee. Thought he was an oily, untrustworthy motherfucker with big teeth. Good-looking wife, though. And he thought the president's 11 o'clock speech had been the usual blah-de-blah. Deke didn't believe a word old Okefenokee said. In his view, the whole thing was probably a hoax. Scare tactics calculated to make the American taxpayer more willing to hike defense spending and thus taxes. There was nobody out there in space. Science had proved it. The only aliens in America, except for President Okefenokee himself, that was, were the Beaners, who swam across the border from Mexico. But people were scared, sitting home and watching TV. A few would be in later for beer or bottles of wine, but for now, the place was as dead as a cat run over on the highway. Deke had turned off the TV half an hour ago. Enough was enough, by the Christ. And when the bell over his door jangled at 1:15, he was studying a magazine from the rack at the back of the store, where a sign proclaimed, "B-21 or Be Gone." This particular periodical was titled, "Lasses in Glasses." A fair title, since all the lasses within were wearing spectacles. Nothing else, but glasses. See? He looked up at the newcomer, started to say something like, "How you doing?" or "Road's getting slippery yet?" and then didn't. He felt a bolt of unease, followed by a sudden certainty that he was going to be robbed. And if robbery was all, he'd be off lucky. He never had been robbed, not in the 12 years he'd owned the place. If a fellow wanted to risk prison for a handful of cash, there were places in the area where bigger handfuls could be had. A guy would have to be... Deke swallowed. A guy would have to be crazy, he'd been thinking. And maybe this guy was. Maybe he was one of those maniacs who'd just offed his whole family and then decided to ramble around a bit, kill a few more folks before turning one of his guns on himself. Deke wasn't paranoid by nature. He was lumpish by nature, his ex-wife would have told you. But that didn't change the fact that he felt suddenly menaced by the afternoon's first customer. He didn't care very much for the fellows who sometimes turned up and loafed around the store, talking about the Patriots or the Red Sox or telling stories about the whoppers they'd caught up to the reservoir. But he wished for a few of them now, a whole gang of them, actually. The man just stood there, inside the door at first, and yeah, there was something wrong with him. He was wearing an orange hunting coat, and deer season hadn't started yet in Massachusetts, but that could have been nothing. What Deke didn't like were the scratches on the man's face, as if he had spent at least some of the last couple of days going cross-country through the woods, and the haunted, drawn quality of the features themselves. His mouth was moving as though he was talking to himself. Something else, too. The gray afternoon light slanting in through the dusty front window glinted oddly on his lips and chin. That son of a bitch is drooling, Deke thought. Be goddamned if he ain't. The newcomer's head snapped around in quick little ticks while his body remained perfectly still, reminding Deke of the way an owl remains perfectly still on its branch as it looks for prey. Deke thought briefly of sliding out of his chair and hiding under the counter, but before he could do more than begin to consider the pros and cons of such a move, not a particularly quick thinker, his ex-wife would have told you that as well, the guy's head did another of those quick flicks and was pointing right at him. The rational part of Deke's mind had been harboring the hope, it was not quite an articulated idea, that he was imagining the whole thing, just suffering the whim-whams from all the weird news and weirder rumors, each dutifully reported by the press coming out of northern Maine. Maybe this was just a guy who wanted smokes or a six-pack, or maybe a bottle of coffee brandy and a stroke book, something to get him through the long, sleety night in a motel outside of Ware or Belchertown. That hope died when the man's eyes met his. It wasn't the gaze of a family-murdering maniac off on his own private cruise to nowhere. It almost would have been better if that had been the case. The newcomer's eyes, far from empty, were too full. A million thoughts and ideas seemed to be crossing them, like one of those big city ticker tapes being run at super speed. They seemed almost to be hopping in their sockets. And they were the hungriest eyes Dick McCaskill had seen in his entire life. "We're closed," Dick said. The words came out in a croak that didn't sound like his voice at all. "Me and my partner, he's in the back. We closed for the day. On account of the goings-on up north, just forgot to flip over the sign. He might have run on for hours, days even, but the man in the hunting coat interrupted him. "Bacon," he said. "Where is it?" Deke knew, suddenly and absolutely, that if he didn't have bacon, this man would kill him. He might kill him anyway, but without bacon, yes, certainly. He did have bacon. Thank God, thank Christ, thank Okey Fanoki and all the hopping ragheads, he did have bacon. "Cooler in back," he said in his new, strange voice. The hand, lying on top of his magazine, felt as cold as a block of ice. In his head, he heard whispering voices that didn't seem to be his own. Red thoughts and black thoughts. Hungry thoughts. An inhuman voice asked, "What's a cooler?" A tired voice, very human, responded, "Go on up the aisle, handsome. You'll see it." Hearing voices, Deke thought. Oh, Jesus, no. That's what happens to people just before they flip out.
The man moved past Deke and up the center aisle. He walked with a heavy limp. There was a phone by the cash register. Deke looked at it, then looked away. It was within reach, and he had 911 on the speed dialer, but it might as well have been on the moon. Even if he was able to summon enough strength to reach for the phone.
I'll know, the inhuman voice said.
And Deke let out a breathless little moan. It was inside his head, as if someone had planted a radio in his brain. There was a convex mirror mounted over the door, a gadget that came in especially handy in the summer when the store was full of kids headed up to the reservoir with their parents. The Quabbin was only 18 miles from here, for fishing or camping or just a picnic. Little bastards were always trying to kite stuff, particularly the candy and the girly magazines. Now Deke looked into it, watching with dread fascination as the man in the orange coat approached the cooler. He stood there a moment, gazing in, then grabbed not just one package of bacon, but all four of them. The man came back down the middle aisle with the bacon, limping along and scanning the shelves. He looked dangerous. He looked hungry. And he also looked dreadfully tired, like a marathon runner going into the last mile. Looking at him gave Deke the same sense of vertigo he felt when he looked down from a high place. It was like looking not at one person, but at several, overlaid and shifting in and out of focus. Deke thought fleetingly of a movie he'd seen, some daffy cunt with about 100 personalities. The man stopped and got a jar of mayonnaise. At the foot of the aisle, he stopped again and snagged a loaf of bread. Then he was at the counter again. Deke could almost smell the exhaustion coming out of his pores and the craziness. He set his purchases down and said,
"Bacon sandwiches on white with mayo. Those are the best."
And smiled. It was a smile of such tired, heartbreaking sincerity that Deke forgot his fear for a moment. Without thinking, he reached out.
"Mister, are you all right?"
Deke's hand stopped, as if it had run into a wall. It trembled for a moment over the counter, then flew up and slapped his own face. Crack! It drew slowly away and stopped, floating like a hovercraft. The third and fourth fingers folded slowly down against the palm.
"Don't kill him. Come out and stop me. If you make me try, you might get a surprise."
These voices were in his head. His hovercraft hand floated forward, and the first two fingers plunged into his nostrils, plugging them. For a moment, they were still. And then, oh dear Christ, they began to dig. And while Dick McCaskill had many questionable habits, chewing his nails was not one of them. At first, his fingers didn't want to move much up there, close quarters. But then, as the lubricating blood began to flow, they became positively frisky. They squirmed like worms. The dirty nails dug like fangs. They shoved up further, burrowing brainward. He could feel cartilage tearing, could hear it. "Stop it, Mr. Gray, stop it!" And suddenly, Deke's fingers belonged to him again. He pulled them free with a wet counter, on rubber chad with the skull logo on it, also on the unlad lass in glasses whose anatomy had been seen when this creature had come in.
"How much do I owe you, Deke?"
"Take it."
Still that crow croak, but now it was a nasal croak, because his nostrils were plugged with blood.
"Aw, man, just take it and go the fuck out of here."
"No, I insist. This is commerce, in which items of real worth are exchanged for currency plain."
$3,
Deke cried. Shock was setting in. His heart was beating wildly, his muscles thrumming with adrenaline. He believed the creature might be going, and this made everything infinitely worse. To be so close to a continued life and still know it could be snatched away at this fucking loony's least whim. The loony brought out a battered old wallet, opened it, and rummaged for what seemed an age. Saliva drizzled steadily from his mouth as he bent over the wallet. At last, he came out with $3. He put them on the counter.
The wallet went back into his pocket. He rummaged in his nasty-looking jeans, rode hard and put away wet, Deke thought, came out with a fistful of change, and laid 3 coins on the skull pad, 2 quarters and a dime.
"I tip 20%, his customer said with unmistakable pride. "Jonesy tips 15. This is better. This is more."
"Sure," Deke whispered. His nose was full of blood.
"Have a nice day. You take it easy."
The man in the orange coat stood with his head lowered. Deke could hear him sorting through possible responses. It made him feel like screaming. At last, the man said,
"I will take it any way I can get it."
There was another pause. Then,
"I don't want you to call anyone, partner."
"I won't."
"Swear to God?"
"Yeah, swear to God."
"I'm like God," his customer remarked.
"Yeah, okay, whatever you..."
"If you call someone, I'll know. I'll come back and fix your wagon."
"I won't."
"Good idea."
He opened the door. The bell jangled. He went out. For a moment, Deke stood where he was, as if frozen to the floor. Then he rushed around the counter, bumping his upper leg hard on the corner. By nightfall, there would be a huge black bruise there, but for the moment, he felt nothing. He turned the thumb lock, shot the bolt, then stood there peering out. Parked in front of the store was a little red shitbox Subaru, mud-splattered, also looking road-hard and put away wet. The man juggled his purchases into the crook of one arm, opened the door, and got in behind the wheel. "Drive away," Deke thought. "Please, mister, for the love of God, just drive away." But he didn't. He picked up something instead, the loaf of bread, and pulled the tie off the end. He took out roughly a dozen slices. Next, he opened the jar of mayonnaise, and, using his finger as a knife, began to slather the slices of bread with mayo. After finishing each slice, he licked his finger clean. Each time he did, his eyes slipped closed, his head tipped back, and an expression of ecstasy filled his features, radiating out from the mouth. When he had finished with the bread, he picked up one of the packages of meat and tore off the paper covering. He opened the plastic inner envelope with his teeth and shook out the pound of sliced bacon. He folded it and put it on a piece of bread, then put another piece on top. He tore into the sandwich as ravenously as a wolf. That expression of divine enjoyment never left his face. It was the look of a man enjoying the greatest gourmet meal of his life. His throat knotted as each huge bite went down. 3 such bites, and the sandwich was gone. As the man in the car reached for 2 more pieces of bread, a thought filled Deke McCaskill's brain, flashing there like a neon sign.
"It's even better this way. Almost alive. Cold, but almost alive."
Deke backed away from the door, moving slowly as if underwater. The grayness of the day seemed to invade the store, dimming the lights. He felt his legs come unhinged, and before the dirty board floor tilted up to meet him, gray had gone to black. When Deke came to, it was later. Just how much later he couldn't tell, because the Budweiser digital clock over the beer cooler was flashing 8888. 3 of his teeth lay on the floor, knocked out when he fell down, he assumed. The blood around his nose and on his chin had dried to a spongy cake. He tried to get up, but his legs wouldn't support him. He crawled to the door instead, with his hair hanging in his face, praying. His prayer was answered. The little red shitbox car was gone. Where it had been were 4 bacon packages, all empty, the mayonnaise jar, 3/4 empty, and 1/2 a loaf of wholesome white bread. Several crows, and there were some almighty big ones around the reservoir, had found the bread and were pecking slices out of the torn wrapper. At a distance, almost back to Route 32, 2 or 3 more were at work on a congealed mess of bacon and matted chunks of bread. Monsieur's gourmet lunch had not agreed with him, it seemed. God, Deke thought. I hope you puked so hard you tore your plumbing loose, you. But then his own guts took a fantastical skipping leap, and he clapped his hand over his mouth. He had a hideously clear image of the man's teeth closing on the raw, fatty meat hanging out between the pieces of bread, gray flesh veined with brown like the severed tongue of a dead horse. Deke began to make muffled, yerking sounds behind his hand. A car turned in. Just what he needed, a customer, while he was on the verge of tossing his cookies. Not really a car at all on second glance, nor a truck either. Not even an SUV, it was one of those god-awful Humvees, painted in smeary camouflage blobs of black and green. Two people in front and, Deke was almost sure of it, another in back. He reached out, flipped the open sign hanging in the door over to closed, then backed away. He had gotten to his feet, had managed at least that much, but now he felt perilously close to collapsing again. They saw me in here just as sure as shit, he thought. They'll come in and ask where the other one went because they're after him. They want him. They want the bacon sandwich man. And I'll tell. They'll make me tell. And then I'll... His hand rose in front of his eyes. The first two fingers, coated with dried blood up to the second knuckles, were poked out and hooked. They were trembling. To Deke, they almost looked like they were waving. Hello, eyes. How you doing? Enjoy looking while you can, because we'll be coming for you soon. The person in the back of the Humvee leaned forward, seemed to say something to the driver, and the vehicle leaped backward, one rear wheel splashing through the puddle of vomit left by the store's last customer. It wheeled around on the road, paused for just a moment, then set off in the direction of Ware and the Quabbin. When they disappeared over the first hill, Deke McCaskill began to weep. As he walked back toward the counter, staggering and weaving but still on his feet, his gaze fell on the teeth lying on the floor. Three teeth. His. A small price to pay. Oh, yes. Teeny Jews. Then he stopped, gazing at the $3 bills which still lay on the counter. They had grown a coating of pale, red-orange fuzz.
Ah, dear! Eep Owen!
Owen? That's me, Owen thought wearily, but he understood Duddits well enough. It wasn't that hard once your ear had become attuned. Not here. Keep going. Owen reversed the Humvee to Route 32 as Duddits sat back, collapsed back, and began to cough again. Look, Henry said, and pointed. See that? Owen saw a bunch of wrappers soaking into the ground under the force of the pelting downpour, and a jar of mayonnaise. He threw the Hummer back into drive and headed north. The rain hitting the windshield had a particularly fat quality that he recognized. Soon it would turn back to sleet, and then, very likely, to snow. Close to exhausted now, and queerly sad in the wake of the telepathy's withdrawing wave, Owen found that his chief regret was having to die on such a dirty day. How far ahead is he now? Owen asked, not daring to ask the real question, the only one that mattered. Are we already too late? He assumed that Henry would tell him, were that the case. He's there, Henry said absently. He had turned around in the seat and was wiping Duddits's face with a damp cloth. Duddits looked at him gratefully and tried to smile. His ashy cheeks were sweaty now, and the black patches under his eyes had spread, turning them into raccoon's eyes. If he's there, why did we have to come here? Owen asked. He had the Hummer up to 70, very dangerous on this slick stretch of two-lane blacktop, but now there was no choice. I didn't want to risk Duddits losing the line, Henry said. If that happens... Duddits uttered a vast groan, wrapped his arms around his midsection, and doubled over them. Henry, still kneeling on the seat, stroked the slender column of his neck. Take it easy, Duds, Henry said. You're all right. But he wasn't. Owen knew it. And so did Henry. Feverish, crampy in spite of a second prednisone pill and two more Percocets, now spraying blood every time he coughed, Duddits Cavell was several country miles from all right. The consolation prize was that the Jonesy-Gray combination was also a very long way from all right. It was the bacon. All they'd hoped to do was to make Mr. Gray stop for a while. None of them had guessed how prodigious his gluttony would turn out to be. The effect on Jonesy's digestion had been fairly predictable. Mr. Gray had vomited once in the parking lot of that little store and had had to pull over twice more on the road to Ware, leaning out the window and offloading several pounds of raw bacon with almost convulsive force. Diarrhea came next. He had to stop at the mobile on Route 9 southeast of Ware and had barely made it into the men's room. The sign outside the station read, "Cheap gas, clean toilets." But the clean toilets part was certainly out of date by the time Mr. Gray left. He didn't kill anyone at the mobile, which Henry counted as a plus. Before turning onto the Quabbin access road, Mr. Gray had needed to stop twice more and dash into the sopping woods where he tried to evacuate Jonesy's groaning bowels. By then, the rain had changed over to huge flakes of wet snow. Jonesy's body had weakened considerably, and Henry was hoping for a faint. So far, it hadn't happened. Mr. Gray was slipped back by the wheel of his second trip into the woods. This was all Jonesy's fault. Jonesy had trapped him. He chose to ignore his own hunger and the compulsive greed with which he had eaten, pausing between bites only to lick the grease from his fingers. Henry had seen such selective arrangements of the facts, emphasizing some, ignoring others completely, many times before in his patience. In some ways, Mr. Gray was Barry Newman all over again. How human he's becoming, he thought. How curiously human. "When you say he's there," Owen asked, "just how there do you mean?" "I don't know. He's closed down again, at least pretty much. Duddits, do you hear Jonesy?" Duddits looked at Henry wearily, then shook his head.
"This is a hook of cards," he said.
"Mr. Gray took our cards." But that was like a literal translation of a slang phrase. Duddits hadn't the vocabulary to express what had actually happened, but Henry could read it in his mind. Mr. Gray was unable to enter Jonesy's office stronghold and take the playing cards, but he had somehow turned them all blank.
"Duddits, how are you making out?" Owen said, looking into the rearview mirror. "IOA," Duddits said, and immediately began to shiver.
On his lap was his yellow lunchbox and the brown bag with his medicines in it, his medicines and that odd little string thing. Surrounding him was the voluminous blue duffel coat, yet inside it he still shivered. "He's going fast," Owen thought as Henry began to swab his old friend's face again. The Humvee skidded on a slick patch, danced on the edge of disaster. A crash at 70 miles per hour would probably kill them all, and even if it didn't, it would put paid to any final thin chance they might have of stopping Mr. Gray, and then came back under control again. Owen found his eyes drifting back to the paper bag, his mind going again to that string thing. "Beaver sent to me for my Christmas last week." Trying to communicate now by telepathy was, Owen thought, like putting a message into a bottle and then tossing the bottle into the ocean. But he did it anyway, sending out a thought in what he hoped was Duddits's direction. "What do you call it, son?" Suddenly and unexpectedly, he saw a large space, a combination living room, dining room, and kitchen. The mellow pine boards glowed with varnish. There was a Navajo rug on the floor, and a tapestry on one wall, tiny Indian hunters surrounding a gray figure, the archetypal alien of 1,000 supermarket tabloids. There was a fireplace, a stone chimney, an oak dining table. But what riveted Owen's attention, it had to, it was the center of the picture Duddits had sent him, and glowed with its own special light, was the string creation which hung from the center rafter. It was the Cadillac version of the one in Duddits's medicine bag, woven in bright colors instead of drab white string, but otherwise the same. Owen's eyes filled with tears. It was the most beautiful room in the world. He felt that way because Duddits felt that way, and Duddits felt that way because it was where his friends went, and he loved them.
"Dream catcher," said the dying man in the back seat,
and he pronounced the word perfectly. Owen nodded. "Dreamcatcher, yes." "It's you," he said, supposing that Henry was overhearing but not caring one way or the other.
The message was for Duddits, strictly for Duddits. You're the Dreamcatcher, aren't you? Their Dreamcatcher. You always were. In the mirror, Duddits smiled. They passed a sign which read, Quabbin Reservoir, 8 miles. No fishing, no services. Picnic area open. Hiking trails open. Pass at own risk. There was more, but at 80 miles an hour, Henry had no time to read it. Any chance he'll park and walk in? Owen asked. Don't even hope for it, Henry said. He'll drive as far as he can. Maybe he'll get stuck. That's what you want to hope for. There's a good chance it might happen. And he's weak. He won't be able to move fast. What about you, Henry? Will you be able to move fast? Considering how stiff he was and how badly his legs ached, that was a fair question. If there's a chance, he said, I'll go as hard as I can. In any case, there's Duddits. I don't think he's going to be capable of a very strenuous hike. Any hike at all, he didn't add. Kurtz and Freddy and Perlmutter. Henry, how far back are they? Considered this. He could feel Perlmutter clearly enough, and he could touch the ravening cannibal inside him as well. It was like Mr. Gray, only the weasel was living in a world made of bacon. The bacon was Archibald Perlmutter, once a captain in the United States Army. Henry didn't like to go there. Too much pain. Too much hunger. 15 miles, he said. Maybe only 12, but it doesn't matter, Owen. We're going to beat them. The only question is whether or not we're going to catch Mr. Gray. We'll need some luck or some help. And if we catch him, Henry, are we still going to be heroes? Henry gave him a tired smile. I guess we'll have to try.
The dog's rear legs were bicycling rapidly, and Mr. Gray could hear the wet sound of tearing flesh as the Byram thrust with one end and chewed with the other, forcing itself out. Beneath the dog's tail, the chittering had started, a sound like an angry monkey. He had to get it into the shaft before it could emerge. It did not absolutely have to be born in the water, but its odds of survival would be much higher if it was. Mr. Gray tried to shove the dog's head into the gap between the cover and the concrete and couldn't get it through. The neck bent, and the dog's senselessly grinning snout twisted upward. Although still so sleeping, or perhaps it was now unconscious, it began to utter a series of low, choked barks. And it wouldn't go through the gap. "Fuck me, Freddy!" Mr. Gray screamed. He was barely aware of the snarling ache in Jonesy's hip now, certainly not aware that Jonesy's face was strained and pale, the hazel eyes wet with tears of effort and frustration. He was aware, terribly aware, that something was going on. Going on behind my back, Jonesy would have said. And who else could it be? Who else but Jonesy, his reluctant host? "Fuck you!" he screamed at the damned, hateful, stubborn, just a little too big dog. "You're going down, you hear me? Do you?" The words stopped in his throat. All at once, he couldn't yell anymore, although he dearly wanted to. How he loved to yell and pound his fists on things, even a dying pregnant dog. All at once, he couldn't breathe, let alone yell. What was Jonesy doing to him? He expected no answer, but one came. A stranger's voice, full of cold rage. "This is how we say welcome to planet Earth." The flailing, three-fingered hands of the gray thing in the hospital bed come up and actually push the pillow aside for a moment. The black eyes, starting from the otherwise featureless face, are frantic with fear and rage. It gasps for breath. Considering that it doesn't really exist at all, not even in Jonesy's brain, at least as a physical artifact, it is fighting furiously for its life. Henry cannot sympathize, but he understands. It wants what Jonesy wants, what Duddits wants, what even Henry himself wants, for in spite of all his black thoughts, has his heart not gone on beating? Has his liver not gone on washing his blood? Has his body not gone on fighting its unseen wars against everything from the common cold to cancer to the virus itself? The body is either stupid or infinitely wise, but in either case, it is spared the terrible witchery of thought. It only knows how to stand its ground and fight until he can fight no more. If Mr. Gray was ever any different, he is different no longer. He wants to live, and he wants to finish the job. But I don't think you will, Henry says in a voice that is calm, almost soothing. I don't think so, my friend. And once more, puts the pillow over Mr. Gray's face. Mr. Gray's airway opened. He got one breath of the cold shaft house air, two, and then the airway closed up again. They were smothering him, stifling him, killing him. No! Kiss my Benda! Kiss my fucking Benda! You can't do this! He yanked the dog back and turned it sideways. It was almost like watching a man already late for his plane trying to make one last bulky article fit into his suitcase. It'll go through this way, he thought. Yes, it would, even if he had to collapse the dog's bulging middle with Jonesy's hands and allow the Byram to squirt free. One way or another, the damned thing would go through. Face swelling, eyes bulging, breath stopped, a single fat vein swelling in the middle of Jonesy's forehead, Mr. Gray shoved Lad deeper into the crack and then began to thump the dog's chest with Jonesy's fists. Go through, damn you, through! Go through! Freddie Johnson pointed his carbine inside the abandoned Hummer, while Kurtz, stationed shrewdly behind him, in that way it was like the attack on the Gray Boy ship all over again, waited to see what would develop. Two guys, boss. Looks like Owen decided to put out the trash before moving on. Dead? He looked pretty dead to me. Got to be Devlin and the one they stopped for. Kurtz joined Freddy, took a brief glance in through the shattered window, and nodded. They looked pretty dead to him, too, a pair of white moles lying entwined in the back seat, covered with blood and shattered glass. He raised his 9mm to make sure of them. One each in the head couldn't hurt. Then lowered it again. Owen might not have heard their engine. The snow was amazingly heavy and wet, an acoustical blanket, and that was very possible. But he would hear gunshots. He turned toward the path instead.
Lead the way, Buck. And mind the footing. Looks slippery. And we may still have the element of surprise. I think we should bear that in mind, don't you?
Freddy nodded. Kurtz smiled. It turned his face into a skull's face.
With any luck, Buck, Owen Underhill will be in hell before he even knows he's dead.
The TV remote, a rectangle of black plastic covered with virus, is lying on Mr. Gray's bed table. Jonesy grabs it. In a voice that sounds eerily like Beaver's, he says, "Fuck this shit," and slams it down as hard as he can on the table's edge, like a man cracking the shell of a hard-boiled egg. The controller shatters, spilling its batteries and leaving a jagged plastic wand in Jonesy's hand. He reaches below the pillow Henry is holding over the thrashing thing's face. He hesitates for just a moment, remembering his first meeting with Mr. Gray, his only meeting. The bathroom knob coming free in his hand as the rod snapped, the sense of darkness which was the creature's shadow falling over him. It had been real enough then, real as roses, real as raindrops. Jonesy had turned and seen him, it, whatever Mr. Gray had been before he was Mr. Gray, standing there in the big central room. The stuff of 100 movies and unexplained mysteries documentaries, only old, old and sick. Ready even then for this hospital bed in the intensive care unit. Mercy, it had said, plucking the word straight out of Jonesy's brain, pulling it like a cork, making the hole through which it could enter. Then it had exploded like a noisemaker on New Year's Eve, spraying virus instead of confetti, and I imagined the rest. That was it, wasn't it? Just another case of intergalactic schizophrenia. Basically, that was it.
Jonesy, Henry shouts. If you're gonna do it, then do it.
Here it comes, Mr. Gray, Jonesy thinks. Get ready for it, because paybacks. Mr. Gray had gotten Lad's body halfway into the gap when Jonesy's voice filled his head. Here it comes, Mr. Gray, get ready for it, because paybacks a bitch. There was a ripping pain across the middle of Jonesy's throat. Mr. Gray raised Jonesy's hands, making a series of gagging grunts that would not quite attain the status of screams. He didn't feel the beard-stubbled, unbroken skin of Jonesy's throat, but his own ragged flesh. What he felt most strongly was shocked disbelief. It was the last of Jonesy's emotions upon which he drew. This could not be happening. They always came in the ships of the old ones, those artifacts. They always raised their hands in surrender. They always won. This could not be happening. And yet somehow it was. The Byram's consciousness did not so much fade as disintegrate. Dying, the entity once known as Mr. Gray reverted to its former state. As he became it, and just before it could become nothing, Mr. Gray gave the dog's body a final, vicious shove. It sank into the gap, yet still not quite far enough to go through. The Byram's last Jonesy-tinged thought was, I should have taken him up on it. I should have gone Jonesy slashes the jagged end of the TV controller across Mr. Gray's naked, wattled neck. Its throat peels open like a mouth, and a cloud of reddish-orange matter puffs out, staining the air the color of blood before falling back to the counterpane in a shower of dust and fluff. Mr. Gray's body twitches once, galvanically, beneath Jonesy's and Henry's hands. Then it shrivels, like the dream it always was, and becomes something familiar. For a moment, Jonesy can't make the connection, and then it comes. Mr. Gray's remains look like one of those condoms they saw on the floor of the deserted office in the Tracker Brothers Depot. He's dead, is how Jonesy means to finish. But then a terrible bolt of pain tears through him. Not his hip this time, but his head and his throat. All at once, his throat is wearing a necklace of fire, and the whole room is transparent, damned if it isn't. He's looking through the wall and into the shaft house where the dog, stuck in the crack, is giving birth to a vile red creature that looks like a weasel crossed with a huge, blood-soaked worm. He knows well enough what it is, one of the Byram. Streaked with blood and shit and the remains of its own membranous placenta, its brainless black eyes staring. They're his eyes, Jonesy thinks, Mr. Gray's eyes. It is being born in front of him, stretching its body out, trying to pull free, wanting to drop into the darkness and fall toward the sound of running water. Jonesy looks at Henry. Henry looks back. For just a moment, their young and startled eyes meet, and then they are disappearing as well. Duddits, Henry says. His voice comes from far away. Duddits is going. Jonesy. Goodbye. Perhaps Henry means to say goodbye. Before he can, they're both gone. There was a moment of vertigo when Jonesy was exactly nowhere, a sense of utter disconnection. He thought it must be death, that he had killed himself as well as Mr. Gray, cut his own throat, as the saying went. What brought him back was pain. Not in his throat, that was gone, and he could breathe again. He could hear the air going in and out of him in great dry gasps. No, this pain was an old acquaintance. It was in his hip. It caught him and swung him back into the world around its swollen, howling axis, winding him up like a tetherball on a post. There was concrete under his knees. His hands were full of fur, and he heard an inhuman chittering sound. At least this part is real, he thought. This part is outside the dream catcher. That god-awful chittering sound. Jonesy saw the weasel thing now dangling into the dark, held to the upper world only by its tail, which wasn't yet free of the dog. Jonesy lunged forward and clamped his hands around its slippery, shivering middle, just as it did pull free. He rocked backward, his bad hip throbbing, holding the writhing, yammering thing above his head like a carny performer with a boa constrictor. It whipped back and forth, teeth gnashing at the air, bending back on itself, trying to get at Jonesy's wrist and snagging the right sleeve of his parka instead, tearing it open and releasing near-weightless tangles of white down filling. Jonesy pivoted on his howling hip and saw a man framed in the broken window through which Mr. Gray had wriggled. The newcomer, his face long with surprise, was dressed in a camouflage parka and holding a rifle. Jonesy flung the wriggling weasel as hard as he could, which wasn't very hard. It flew perhaps 10 feet, landed on the leaf-littered floor with a wet thump, and immediately began slithering back toward the shaft. The dog's body plugged part of it, but not enough. There was plenty of room.
"Shoot it!" Jonesy screamed at the man with the rifle. "For God's sake, shoot it before it can get into the water!"
But the man in the window did nothing. The world's last hope only stood there with his mouth hanging open. Owen simply couldn't believe what he was seeing. Some sort of red thing, a freakish weasel with no legs. To hear about such things was one matter. To actually see one was another. It squirmed toward the hole in the middle of the floor. A dog with its stiffening paws held up as if in surrender was wedged there. The man, it had to be Typhoid Jonesy, was screaming at him to shoot the thing, but Owen's arms simply wouldn't come up. They seemed to be coated in lead. The thing was going to get away. After all that had happened, what he had hoped to prevent was going to happen right in front of him. It was like being in hell. He watched it wriggle forward, making a god-awful monkey sound that he seemed to hear in the center of his head. He watched Jonesy lunging with desperate awkwardness, hoping to catch it or at least head it off. It wasn't going to work. The dog was in the way. Owen again commanded his arms to raise the gun and point it, but nothing happened. The MP5 might as well have been in another universe. He was going to let it get away. He was going to stand here like a post and let it get away. God help him. God help them all. Henry sat up in the back seat of the Humvee, dazed. There was stuff in his hair. He brushed at it, still feeling caught in the dream of the hospital, except that was no dream, he thought. And then a sharp prick of pain restored him to something like reality. It was glass. His hair was filled with glass. More of it, safety glass crumbles of it, covered the seat and Duddits. Dud. Useless, of course. Duddits was dead. Must be dead. He had expended the last of his failing energy to bring Jonesy and Henry together in that hospital room. But Duddits groaned. His eyes opened, and looking into them brought Henry all the way back to this snowy dead-end road. Duddits's eyes were red and bloody zeros, the eyes of a sibyl.
"Ubi!"
Duddits cried. His hands rose and made a weak aiming gesture, as if he held a rifle.
"Ubi-doo! At-sum-uk-doo now!"
From somewhere up ahead in the woods, two rifle shots came in answer. A pause, then a third one.
"Dud!" Henry whispered. "Duddits!"
Duddits saw him. Even through his bloody eyes, Duddits saw him. Henry more than felt this. For a moment, he actually saw himself through Duddits's eyes. It was like looking into a magic mirror. He saw the Henry who had been, a kid looking out at the world through horn-rimmed glasses that were too big for his face and always sliding down to the end of his nose. He felt Duddits's love for him, a simple and uncomplicated emotion, untinctured by doubt or selfishness or even gratitude. Henry took Duddits in his arms, and when he felt the lightness of his old friend's body, Henry began to cry.
"You were the lucky one, Bud," he said, and wished Beaver were here.
Beaver could have done what Henry could not. Beav could have sung Duddits to sleep.
"You were always the lucky one. That's what I think." "Any,"
Duddits said, and touched Henry's cheek with one hand. He was smiling, and his final words were perfectly clear.
"I love you, Annie."
Two shots rang out up ahead. Carbine whip cracks. Not far up ahead, either. Kurtz stopped. Freddy was about 20 feet ahead of him, standing by a sign Kurtz could just make out. Absolutely no fishing from Shaft House. A third shot. Then silence.
"Boss?"
Freddy murmured. "Some kind of building up ahead. Can you see anyone?" Freddy shook his head. Kurtz joined him, amused even at this point at the slight jump Freddy gave when Kurtz put his hand on Freddy's shoulder. And he was right to jump. If Abe Kurtz survived the next 15 or 20 minutes, he intended to go forward alone into whatever brave new world there might be. No one to slow him down, no witnesses to this final guerrilla action. And while he might suspect, Freddy couldn't know for sure. Too bad that telepathy was gone. Too bad for Freddy.
Sounds like Owen found someone else to kill.
Kurtz spoke low into Freddy's ear, which still sported a few curls of the Ripley, now white and dead. Do we go get him?
Goodness, no, Kurtz replied. Perish the thought. I believe the time has come. Regrettably, it comes in almost every life, when we must step off the path, Buck. Mingle with the trees. See who stays and who comes back. If anyone does, we'll give it 10 minutes, shall we? I think 10 minutes should be more than enough.
The words which filled Owen Underhill's mind were nonsensical, but unmistakable. Scooby, Scooby-Doo, got some work to do now. The carbine came up. He wasn't the one who did it, but when the force lifting the rifle left him, Owen was able to take over smoothly. He flicked the auto's selector switch to single-shot fire, sighted, and squeezed the trigger twice. The first round missed, hitting the concrete in front of the weasel and ricocheting. Chips of concrete flew. The thing pulled back, turned, saw him, and bared its mouthful of needle teeth.
That's right, beautiful, Owen said. Smile for the camera.
His second shot went right through the weasel's humorless grin. It tumbled backward, struck the wall of the shaft house, then fell to the concrete. Yet even with its rudiment of a head blown off, its instincts remained. It began to crawl slowly forward again. Owen aimed, and as he centered the sight, he thought of the Rapallos, Dick and Irene. Nice people. Good neighbors. If you needed a cup of sugar or a pint of milk, or a shoulder to cry on for that matter, you could always go next door and get fixed up. They said it was a stroke, Mr. Rapallo had called. Only Owen had thought he was saying stork. Kids got everything wrong. So this was for the Rapallos, and for the kid who had kept getting it wrong. Owen fired a third time. This slug caught the Byram amidships and tore it in two. The ragged pieces twitched, twitched, lay still. With that done, Owen swung his carbine in a short arc. This time, he settled the sight on the middle of Gary Jones's forehead. Jonesy looked unblinkingly back at him. Owen was tired, almost to death, that was what it felt like, but this guy looked far past even that point. Jonesy raised his empty hands. "You have no reason to believe this," he said, "but Mr. Gray is dead. I cut his throat while Henry held a pillow over his face. It was right out of The Godfather."
"Really?" Owen said.
There was no inflection in his voice whatsoever. "And where exactly did you perform this execution?"
"In a Massachusetts General Hospital of the Mind," Jonesy said.
He then uttered the most joyless laugh Owen had ever heard in his life.
"When we're deer roam the halls, and the only TV program is an old movie called Sympathy for the Devil."
Owen jerked a little at that.
"Shoot me if you have to, soldier. I saved the world, with a little ninth-inning relief help from you, I freely admit. You might as well pay me for the service in the traditional manner. Also, the bastard broke my hip again. A little going-away present from the little man who wasn't there. The pain is..."
Jonesy bared his teeth.
"It's very large."
Owen held the gun where it was a moment longer, then lowered it.
"You can live with it," he said.
Jonesy fell backward on the points of his elbows, groaned, turned his weight as well as he could onto his unhurt side.
"Duditz is dead. He was worth both of us put together. More. And he's dead."
He covered his eyes for a moment, then dropped his arm.
"Man, what a fuck-a-row this is. That's what Bieber would have called it, a total fuck-a-row. That is opposed to a fuckery, you understand, which in Beaverese means a particularly fine time. possibly, but not necessarily, of a sexual nature.
Owen had no idea what the man was talking about. Likely, he was delirious.
Duddits may be dead, but Henry's not. There are some people after us, Jonesy. Bad people. Do you hear them? Know where they are?
Lying on the cold, leaf-littered floor, Jonesy shook his head.
I'm back to the stand at 5 cents, I'm afraid. ESP's all gone. The Greeks may come bearing gifts, but they're Indian givers.
He laughed.
Jesus, I could lose my job for a crack like that. Sure you don't want to just shoot me?
Owen paid no more attention to this than he had to the semantical differences between fuckerow and fuckeree. Kurtz was coming. That was the problem he had to deal with now. He hadn't heard him arrive, but he might not have done. The snow was falling heavily enough to damp all but loud sounds, gunshots, for instance. I have to go back to the road, he said. You hang in there.
What choice? Jonesy asked, and closed his eyes. Man, I wish I could go back to my nice warm office. I never thought I'd say that, but there it is.
Owen turned and went back down the steps, slipping and sliding, but managing to keep his feet. He scanned the woods to either side of the path, but not closely. If Kurtz and Freddy were laid up, waiting someplace between here and the Hummer, he doubted he would see them in time to do anything. He might see tracks, but by then, he'd be so close to them, they'd likely be the last things he saw. He had to hope he was still ahead, that was all. Had to trust to plain old bald-ass luck, and why not? He'd been in plenty of tight places, and bald-ass luck had always pulled him through. Maybe it would do so again. The first bullet took him in the belly, knocking him backward and blowing the back of his coat out in a bell shape. He pumped his feet, trying to stay upright, also trying to hang on to the MP5. There was no pain, just a feeling of having been sucker-punched by a large boxing glove on the fist of a mean opponent. The second round shaved the side of his head, producing a burn and sting like rubbing alcohol poured into an open wound. The third shot hit him high up on the right side of the chest, and that was Katie by the door. He lost both his feet and the carbine. What had Jonesy said? Something about having saved the world and getting paid off in the traditional manner? And this wasn't so bad, really. It had taken Jesus 6 hours. They'd put a joke sign over his head, and come cocktail hour, they'd given him a stiff vinegar and water. He lay half on and half off the snow-covered path, vaguely aware that something was screaming, and it wasn't him. It sounded like an enormous pissed-off blue jay. That's an eagle, Owen thought. He managed to get a breath, and although the exhale was more blood than air, he was able to get up on his elbows. He saw two figures emerge from the tangle of birches and pines, bent low, very much in combat advance mode. One was squat and broad-shouldered, the other slim and gray-haired and positively perky. Johnson and Kurtz, the bulldog and the greyhound. His luck had run out after all. In the end, luck always did. Kurtz knelt beside him, eyes sparkling. In one hand, he held a triangle of newspaper. It was battered and slightly curved from its long trip in Kurtz's rear pocket, but still recognizable. It was a cocked hat. A fool's hat.
Tough luck, Buck, Kurtz said.
Owen nodded. It was. Very tough luck.
See, you found time to make me a little something.
I did, laddie. Did you achieve your prime objective at least?
Kurtz lifted his chin in the direction of the shaft house.
Got him,
Owen managed. His mouth was full of blood. He spat it out, tried to pull in another breath, and heard the good part of it wheeze out of some new hole instead.
Well, then, Kurtz said benevolently, all's well that ends well, wouldn't you say?
He put the newspaper hat tenderly on Owen's head. Blood soaked it immediately, spreading upward, turning the UFO story red. There was another scream from somewhere out over the reservoir, perhaps from one of the islands that were actually hills poking up from a purposely drowned landscape.
That's an eagle, Kurtz said, and patted Owen's shoulder. Count yourself lucky, laddie. God sent you a warbird to sing you to...
Kurtz's head exploded in a spray of blood and brains and bone. Owen saw a one final expression in the man's blue, white-lashed eyes. Amazed disbelief. For a moment, Kurtz remained on his knees, then toppled forward on what remained of his face. Behind him, Freddie Johnson stood with his carbine still raised and smoke drifting from the muzzle. "Freddie," Owen tried to say. No sound came out, but Freddie must have read his lips. He nodded. "Didn't want to, but the bastard was going to do it to me. Didn't have to read his mind to know that, not after all these years." "Finish it," Owen tried to say. Freddie nodded again. Perhaps there was a vestige of that goddamn telepathy left inside Freddie after all. Owen was fading, tired and fading. "Good night, sweet ladies. Good night, David. Good night, Chet. Good night, sweet prince." He lay back on the snow, and it was like falling back into a bed stuffed with the softest down. From somewhere, faint and far, he heard the eagle scream again. They had invaded its territory, disturbed its snowy autumn peace, but soon they would be gone. The eagle would have the reservoir to itself again. "We were heroes," Owen thought. "Damned if we weren't." "Fuck your hat, Kurtz. We were hit." He never heard the final shot. There had been more firing. Now there was silence. Henry sat in the back seat of the Humvee beside his dead friend, trying to decide what to do next. The chances that they had all killed each other seemed slim. The chances that the good guys, correction, the good guy, had taken out the bad ones seemed slimmer still. His first impulse following this conclusion was to vacate the Hummer post-haste and hide in the woods. Then he looked at the snow. "If I ever see snow again," he thought, "it'll be too soon," and rejected the idea. If Kurtz or whoever was with him came back in the next half hour, Henry's tracks would still be there. They would follow his trail, and at the end of it, they'd shoot him like a rabid dog or a weasel. "Get a gun, then. Shoot them before they can shoot you." A better idea. He was no Wyatt Earp, but he could shoot straight. Shooting men was a lot different from shooting deer. He didn't have to be a head shrinker to know that, but he believed, given a clear line of fire, he could shoot these guys with very little hesitation. He was reaching for the door handle when he heard a surprised curse, a thump, yet another gunshot. This one was very close. Henry thought someone had lost his footing and gone down in the snow, discharging his weapon when he landed on his ass. Perhaps the son of a bitch had just shot himself. Was that too much to hope for? Wouldn't that just... But no, no joy. Henry heard a low grunt as the person who'd fallen got up and came on again. There was only one option, and Henry took it. He lay back down on the seat, put Duditz's arms around him again as best he could, and played dead. He didn't think there was much chance this hugger-mugger would work. The bad guys had passed by on their way in, obviously as he was still alive. But on their way in, they must have been in a pants-ripping hurry. Now they would be a lot less likely to be fooled by a few bullet holes, some broken glass, and the blood of poor old Duditz's final hemorrhages. Henry heard soft, crunching footsteps in the snow. Only one set by the sound. Probably the infamous Kurtz. Last man standing. Darkness approaching. Death in the afternoon. No longer his old friend. Now he was only playing dead. But approaching. Just the same. Henry closed his eyes, waited. The footsteps passed the Humvee without slowing. Freddie Johnson's strategic goal was, for the time being, both extremely practical and extremely short-term. He wanted to get the goddamn Hummer turned around without getting stuck. If he managed that, he wanted to get past the break in East Street where the Subaru Owen had been chasing had come to grief without getting ditched himself. If he made it back to the access road, he might widen his horizons a trifle. The idea of the Mass Pike surfaced briefly in his mind as he swung open the door of the boss's Hummer and slid behind the wheel. There was a lot of Western America down I-90, a lot of places to hide. The stench of stale farts and chilly ethyl alcohol struck him like a slap as he swung the door closed. Pearly, goddamn Pearly. In the excitement, he had forgotten all about that little motherfucker. Freddy turned, raising the carbine, but Pearlie was still out cold. No need to use another bullet. He could just tip Perlmutter out into the snow. If he was lucky, Pearlie would freeze to death without ever waking up. Him and his little sidekick. Pearlie wasn't sleeping, though. Nor out cold. Nor in a coma. Not even that. Pearlie was dead. And he was shrunken somehow. Almost mummified. His cheeks were drawn in, hollow, wrinkled. The sockets of his eyes were deep divots, as if behind the thin veils of his closed lids the eyeballs had fallen into what was now a hollow bucket. And he was tilted strangely against the passenger door, one leg raised, almost crossed over the other. It was as if he had died trying to perform the ever-popular one-cheek sneak. His fatigue pants were now dark, the muted colors turned to mud, and the seat under him was wet. The fingers of the stain spreading toward Freddy were red. What the fu-? From the back seat there arose an ear-splitting yammering. It was like listening to a powerful stereo turned rapidly up to full volume. Freddy caught movement from the corner of his right eye. A creature beyond belief appeared in the rearview mirror. It tore off Freddy's ear and then struck at his cheek, punched through into his mouth, and latched onto his jaw at the inner gum line. And then Archie Perlmutter's shit weasel tore off the side of Freddy's face as a hungry man might tear a drumstick off a chicken. Freddy shrieked and discharged his weapon into the passenger door of the Hummer. He got an arm up, tried to shove the thing off. His fingers slipped on its slick newborn skin. The weasel withdrew, tossed its head back, and swallowed what it had torn off like a parrot with a piece of raw steak. Freddy flailed for the driver's side door handle and found it, but before he could yank it up, the thing struck again, this time burying its mouth in the muscular flesh where Freddy's neck and shoulder merged. There was a vast jet of blood as his jugular opened. It spurted up to the Humvee's roof, then began to drip back like red rain. Freddy's feet jittered, bopping the Humvee's wide brake in a rapid tap dance. The creature in the back seat drew back again, seemed to consider, then slithered snake-like over Freddy's shoulder. It dropped into his lap. Freddy screamed once as the weasel tore off his plumbing, and then he screamed no more. Henry sat twisted around in the back seat of the other Humvee, watching as the figure in the vehicle parked behind him jerked back and forth behind the wheel. Henry was glad of the thickly falling snow, equally glad of the blood that sprayed up, striking the windshield of the other Humvee, partially obscuring the view. He could see all too well as it was. At last, the figure behind the wheel stopped moving and fell sideways. A bulky shadow rose over it, seeming to hulk in triumph. Henry knew what it was. He'd seen one on Jonesy's bed back at Hole in the Wall. One thing he could see was that there was a broken window in the Humvee which had been chasing them. He doubted if the thing had much in the way of intelligence, but how much would it need to register fresh air? They don't like the cold. It kills them. Yes, indeed it did. But Henry had no intention of leaving it at that, and not just because the reservoir was so close he could hear the water lapping on the rocks. Something had run up an extremely high debt, and only he was left to present the bill. Payback's a bitch, as Jonesy had so often observed, and payback time had arrived. He leaned over the seat. No weapons there. He leaned over further and thumbed open the glove compartment. Nothing in there but a litter of invoices, gasoline receipts, and a tattered paperback titled How to Be Your Own Best Friend. Henry opened the door, got out into the snow, and his feet immediately flew out from under him. He went on his butt with a thump, and scraped his back on the Hummer's high splashboard. Fuck me, Freddy. He got up, slipped again, grabbed the top of the open door, and managed to stay afoot this time. He shuffled his feet around to the back of the vehicle he'd come in, never taking his eyes from its twin parked behind. He could still see the thing inside thrashing and shuffling, dining on the driver. Stay where you are, beautiful, Henry said, and began to laugh. The laughter sounded crazy as hell, but that didn't stop him. Lay a few eggs. I am the Eggman, after all, your friendly neighborhood Eggman.
Well, how about a copy of How to Be Your Own Best Friend? I got one. Laughing so hard now he could barely speak, sliding in the wet and treacherous snow like a kid let out of school and on his way to the nearest sledding hill, holding onto the flank of the Hummer as best he could, except there was really nothing to hold onto once you were south of the doors, watching the thing shift and move. And then he couldn't see it anymore. Uh-oh. Where the hell had it gotten to? In one of Jonesy's dopey movies, this is where the scary music would start, Henry thought. Attack of the killer shit weasels. That got him laughing again. He was around to the back of the vehicle now. There was a button you could push to unlatch the rear window, unless, of course, it was locked. Probably wasn't, though. Hadn't Owen gotten into the back this way? Henry couldn't remember. Couldn't for the life of him. He was clearly not being his own best friend. Still cackling, fresh tears gushing out of his eyes, he thumbed the button, and the back window popped open. Henry yanked it wider and looked in. Guns, thank God. Army carbines like the one that Owen had taken on his last patrol. Henry grabbed one and examined it. Safety, check. Fire selection switch, check. Clip marked U.S. Army 5.56 Cal 120 rounds, check. So simple even a Byram can do it, Henry said, and laughed some more. He bent over, holding his stomach and slipping around in the slop, trying not to fall again. His legs ached, his back ached, his heart ached most of all, and still he laughed. He was the Eggman, he was the Eggman, he was the laughing hyena. He walked around to the driver's side of Kurtz's Humvee, gun raised, safety in what he devoutly hoped was the off position. Spooky music playing in his head, but still laughing. There was the gasoline hatch, no mistaking that. But where was Gamera, the terror from beyond space? As if it had heard his thought, and Henry realized that was perfectly likely, the weasel smashed head first against the rear window. The one that was, thankfully, unbroken. Its head was smeared with blood, hair, and bits of flesh. Its dreadful sea-grape eyes stared into Henry's. Did it know it had a way out, an escape hatch? Perhaps. And perhaps it understood that using it would likely mean a quick death. It bared its teeth. Henry Devlin, who had once won the American Psychiatric Association's Compassionate Caring Award for a New York Times op-ed piece called The End of Hate, bared his own in return. It felt good. Then he gave it the finger, for Beaver, and for Pete. That felt good, too. When he raised the carbine, the weasel, stupid perhaps, but not utterly stupid, dove out of sight. That was cool. Henry had never had the slightest intention of trying to shoot it through the window. He did like the idea of it down there on the floor, though. Close to the gas as you want to get, darling, he thought. He thumbed the carbine selector switch to full auto and fired a long burst into the gas tank. The sound of the gun was deafening. A huge, ragged hole appeared where the gasoline port had been, but for a moment, there was nothing else. So much for the Hollywood version of how shit like this works, Henry thought, and then heard a hoarse whisper of sound rising to a throaty hiss. He took two steps backward, and his feet shot out from under him again. This time, falling quite likely saved his eyesight and perhaps his life. The back of Kurtz's Humvee exploded only a second later, fire lashing out from underneath in big yellow petals. The rear tires jumped out of the snow. Glass sprayed through the snowy air, all of it going over Henry's head. Then the heat began to bake him, and he crawled away rapidly, dragging the carbine by its strap and laughing wildly. There was a second explosion, and the air was filled with whirling hooks of shrapnel. Henry got to his feet like a man climbing a ladder, using the lower branches of a handy tree as rungs. He stood, panting and laughing, legs aching, back aching, neck with an odd sprung feeling. The entire back half of Kurtz's Humvee was engulfed in flames. He could hear the thing inside chittering furiously as it burned. He made a wide circle to the passenger side of the blazing Humvee and aimed the carbine at the broken window. He stood there for a moment, frowning, then realized why this seemed so stupid. All the windows in the Humvee were broken now,
all the glass but the windshield. He began to laugh again. What a dork he was. What a total dork. Through the hell of flames in the Humvee's cabin, he could still see the weasel lurching back and forth like a drunk. How many rounds did he have left in the clip if the fucking thing did come out? 50? 20? 5? However many rounds there were, it would have to be enough. He wouldn't risk retreating to Owen's Humvee for another clip. But the thing never came out. Henry stood guard for 5 minutes, then stretched it to 10. The snow fell, and the Humvee burned, pouring black smoke into the white sky. Henry stood there, thinking of the Dairy Days parade, and here come a tall man on stilts, here come the legendary cowboy, and how excited Duddits had been, jumping right up and down. Thinking of Pete, standing outside DJHS, hands cupped, pretending to smoke, waiting for the rest of them. Pete, whose plan had been to captain NASA's first manned Mars expedition. Thinking of Beaver and his Fonzie jacket, Beave and his toothpicks, Beave singing to Duddits, "Baby's boat's a silver dream." Beave hugging Jonesy at Jonesy's wedding and saying Jonesy had to be happy. He had to be happy for all of them. Jonesy. When Henry was absolutely sure the weasel was dead, incinerated, he started up the path to see if Jonesy was still alive. He didn't hold out much hope of that, but he discovered that he hadn't given up hope either.
By the time Owen got to the place where East Street ended, or turned into the northeast meandering Fitzpatrick Road, depending on your interpretation, he could hear Kurtz behind him, and guessed that Kurtz could probably hear him as well. The Humvees weren't as loud as Harley's, but they were a long way from quiet. Jonesy's footprints were entirely gone now, but Owen could see the path which led down from the road and along the shore of the reservoir. He killed the engine. "Henry, it looks like we're walking from hi..." Owen stopped. He had been concentrating too hard on his driving to look behind him or even check the rearview mirror, and he was unprepared for what he now saw. Unprepared and appalled. Henry and Duddits were wrapped in what Owen first believed was a terminal embrace. Their stubbly cheeks pressed together, their eyes closed, their faces and coats smeared with blood. He could see neither of them breathing, and thought they had actually died together, Duddits of his leukemia, Henry perhaps of a heart attack brought on by exhaustion and by the constant unrelieved stress of the last 30 hours or so. And then he saw the minute twitch of the eyelids, both sets, embracing, splattered with blood, but not dead, sleeping. Dreaming. Owen started to call Henry's name again, and then reconsidered. Henry had refused to leave the compound back in Jefferson Tract without freeing the detainees, and although they'd gotten away with that one, it had only been through the sheerest luck or providence, if you believe that was any more than a TV show. Nevertheless, they had gotten Kurtz on their tail, and Kurtz had hung on like a booger, and now he was a lot closer than he would have been had Owen and Henry simply crept out into the storm. "Well, I wouldn't change that," Owen thought, opening the driver's door and getting out. Somewhere north, away in the white blank of the storm, came the scream of an eagle bitching about the weather. From behind, south, came the approaching racket of Kurtz, that annoying madman. It was impossible to tell how close because of the fucking snow. Coming down this fast and hard, it was like a sound baffle. He could be 2 miles back, he could be a lot closer. Freddy would be with him, fucking Freddy, the perfect soldier, Dolph Lundgren from hell. Owen went around to the back of the car, slipping and sliding in the snow, cursing it, and popped the Humvee's back gate, expecting automatic weapons, hoping for a portable rocket launcher. No rocket launcher, no grenades either, but there were 4 MP5 auto-fire rifles and a carton containing long banana clips, the ones that held 120 rounds. He had played it Henry's way back at the compound, and Owen guessed that they had saved at least some lives, but he would not play it Henry's way this time. If he hadn't paid enough for the Rapallo's goddamn serving platter, he would simply have to live with the debt. Not for long, either, if Kurtz had his way. Henry was either sleeping, unconscious, or joined to his dying childhood friend in some weird mind meld. Let it be, then. Awake and by his side, Henry might balk at what needed to be done, especially if Henry was right in believing his other friend was still alive, hiding out in the mind the alien now controlled. Owen would not balk, and with the telepathy gone, he wouldn't hear Jonesy pleading for his life if he was still in there. The Glock was a good weapon, but not sure enough. The MP5 would rip the body of Gary Jones apart. Owen grabbed one, plus three extra clips which he stuffed into his coat pockets. Kurt's close now. Close, close, close. He looked back at East Street, almost expecting to see the second Humvee materializing like a green-brown ghost. But as yet, there was nothing. Praise Jesus, as Kurtz would say. The Hummer's windows were already glazing over with snow, but he could see the dim shapes of the two men in the rear seat as he passed back along the body of the vehicle, trotting now, still locked in each other's arms. "Goodbye, boys," he said. "Sleep well." And, with any luck, they would still be sleeping when Kurtz and Freddy arrived, putting an end to their lives before moving on after their main quarry. Owen stopped suddenly, skidding in the snow and grabbing the Humvee's long hood to keep from falling. Duddits was clearly a lost cause, but he might be able to save Henry Devlin. It was just possible. "No," part of his mind screamed as he started back for the rear door. "No, there's no time." But Owen decided to gamble that there was. To gamble the whole world. Maybe to pay a little more on what he owed for the Rapallo's plate. Maybe for what he had done yesterday, those naked gray figures standing around their downed ship with their arms held up as if in surrender. Probably just for Henry, who had told him they would be heroes, and who had tried, splendidly, to fulfill that promise. No sympathy for the devil, he thought, wrenching open the rear door. No, sir, zero sympathy for that motherfucker. Duddits was closer. Owen seized him by the collar of his big blue duffel coat and yanked. Duddits toppled sideways onto the seat. His hat fell off, revealing his shining, bald skull. Henry, with his arms still around Duddits's shoulders, came with him, landing on top. His eyes didn't open, but he groaned softly. Owen whispered fiercely into Henry's ear, "Don't sit up! For the love of God, Henry, don't you sit up!" Owen withdrew, slammed the door, backed off three steps, placed the butt of the rifle against his hip, and fired a burst. The Humvee's windows turned to milk, then fell in. Casings clinked around Owen's feet. He stepped forward again and looked through the shattered window into the rear seat. Henry and Duddits still lay there, now covered with crumbles of safety glass as well as Duddits's blood, and to Owen, they looked like the two deadest people he had ever seen. Owen hoped Kurtz would be in too much of a hurry for a close examination. In any case, he had done the best he could. He heard a hard, metallic jouncing sound and grinned. That place Kurtz, by God. They'd reached the washout where the Subaru had finished up. He wished mightily that Kurtz and Freddy had rear-ended the fucking thing, but the sound had not, unfortunately, been that loud. Still, it placed them a mile back at least. Not as bad as he'd thought. "Plenty of time," he muttered. And that might be true of Kurtz, but what about the other end? Where was Mr. Gray now? Holding the MP5 by the strap, Owen started down the path that led to Shaft 12. Mr. Gray had discovered another unlovely human emotion, panic. He had come all this way, light years through space, miles through the snow, to be balked by Jonesy's muscles, which were weak and out of shape, and the iron shaft cover, which was much heavier than he had expected. He yanked down on the crowbar until Jonesy's back muscles screamed in agonized protest, and was finally rewarded by a brief wink of darkness from beneath the edge of the rusty iron, and a grinding sound as it moved a bit, perhaps no more than an inch or two, on the concrete. Then Jonesy's lower back muscles locked up, and Mr. Gray staggered away from the shaft, crying out through clenched teeth. Thanks to his immunity, Jonesy still had a full set of them, and pressing his hands to the base of Jonesy's spine as if to keep it from exploding. Ladd let out a series of yipping whines. Mr. Gray looked at him and saw that things had now reached the critical juncture. Although he was still asleep, Ladd's abdomen was now so grotesquely swelled that one of his legs stuck stiffly up in the air. The skin of his lower belly had stretched to the point of splitting, and the veins there pulsed with clock-like rapidity. A trickle of bright blood spilled out from beneath his tail. Mr. Gray looked balefully at the crowbar jutting from the slot in the iron cover. In Jonesy's imagination, the Russian woman had been a slim beauty with dark hair and dark, tragic eyes. In reality, Mr. Gray thought, she must have been broad-shouldered and muscular. How else could she have... There was a blast of gunfire, alarmingly close. Mr. Gray gasped and looked around. Thanks to Jonesy, the human corrosion of doubt was also part of his makeup now. And for the first time, he realized that he might be balked. Yes, even here, so close to his goal that he could hear it, the sound of rushing water starting on its 60-mile underground journey. And all that stood between the Byram and this whole world was a circular iron plate weighing 120 pounds. Screaming a thin and desperate litany of beaver curses, Mr. Gray rushed forward, Jonesy's failing body jerking back and forth on the defective pivot point of its right hip. One of them was coming, the one called Owen, and Mr. Gray dared not believe he could make this Owen turn his weapon on himself. Given time, given the element of surprise, maybe. Now he had neither. And this man who was coming had been trained to kill. It was his career. Mr. Gray leaped into the air. There was a snap, quite audible, as Jonesy's overstressed hip broke free of the swollen socket which had held it. Mr. Gray landed on the crowbar with Jonesy's full weight. The edge lifted again, and this time the cover slid almost a foot across the concrete. The black crescent through which the Russian woman had slipped appeared again. Not much of a crescent, really no more than a delicate capital C drawn with a calligrapher's pen, but enough for the dog. Jonesy's leg would no longer support Jonesy's weight. And where was Jonesy, anyway? Still not a murmur from his troublesome host. But that was all right. Crawling would do now. Mr. Gray worked his way in such fashion across the cold cement floor to where the sleeping border collie lay, seized Lad by his collar, and began to drag him back to Shaft 12. The Hall of Memories, that vast repository of boxes, is also on the verge of shaking itself apart. The floor shudders as if in the grip of an endless, slow earthquake. Overhead, the fluorescents flicker on and off, giving the place a stuttery, hallucinatory look. In places, tall stacks of cartons have fallen over, blocking some of the corridors. Jonesy runs as best he can. He moves from corridor to corridor, threading his way through this maze purely on instinct. He tells himself repeatedly to ignore the goddamn hip. He has nothing but mind now anyway, but he might as well be an amputee trying to convince his missing limb to stop throbbing. He runs past boxes marked Austro-Hungarian War and Departmental Politics and Children's Stories and Contents of Upstairs Closet. He hurdles a pile of tumbled boxes marked Carla, comes down on his bad leg and screams at the pain. He clutches more boxes, those marked Gettysburg, in order to keep from falling, and at last sees the far side of the storage room. Thank God, it seems to him that he has run miles. The door is marked ICU, and Quiet Please, and No Visitors Without Pass. And that is right. This is where they took him. This is where he had awakened and heard crafty old Mr. Death pretending to call for Marcy. Jonesy bangs through the door and into another world, one he recognizes. The blue over white ICU corridor where he took his first painful tentative steps 4 days after his surgery. He stumbles a dozen feet down the tiled corridor, sees the splotches of virus growing on the walls, hears the Muzak, which is decidedly unhospital-like. Although it's turned low, it appears to be the Rolling Stones singing Sympathy for the Devil. He has no more than identified this song when his hip suddenly goes nuclear. Jonesy utters a surprised scream and falls to the black and red ICU tiles, clutching at himself. This is how it was just after he was hit, an explosion of red agony. He rolls over and over, looking up at the glowing light panels, at the circular speakers from which the music, Anastasia screamed in vain, is coming, music from another world. When the pain is this bad, everything is in another world. Pain makes a shadow of substance and a mockery even of love. That is something he learned in March and must learn again now. He rolls and he rolls, hands clutching at his swollen hip, eyes bulging, mouth pulled back in a vast rictus, and he knows what has happened, all right. Mr. Gray, That son of a bitch, Mr. Gray, has rebroken his hip. Then, from far away in that other world, he hears a voice he knows. A kid's voice.
Jonesy!
Echoing, distorted, but not that far away. Not this corridor, but one of the adjacent ones. Whose voice? One of his own kids? John, maybe? No.
Jonesy, you have to hurry. He's coming to kill you. Owen is coming to kill you.
He doesn't know who Owen is, but he knows who that voice belongs to, Henry Devlin. But not as it is now, or as it was when he last saw Henry going off to Goslin's Market with Pete. This is the voice of the Henry he grew up with, the one who told Richie Grenadol that they'd tell on him if he didn't stop, that Richie and his friends would never catch Pete because Pete ran like the fucking wind.
I can't, he calls back, still rolling on the floor.
He is aware that something has changed, is still changing, but not what.
I can't. He broke my hip again. The son of a bitch broke.
And then he realizes what is happening to him. The pain is running backward. It is like watching a videotape as it rewinds. The milk flows up from the glass to the carton. The flower, which should be blooming through the miracle of time-lapse photography, closes up instead. The reason is obvious when he looks down at himself and sees the bright orange jacket he's wearing. It's the one his mother bought him in Sears for his first hunting trip to Hole in the Wall, the trip when Henry got his deer, and they all killed Richie Grenadol and his friends. Killed them with a dream, maybe not meaning to, but doing it just the same. He has become a child again, a kid of 14, and there is no pain. Why would there be? His hip will not be broken for another 23 years. And then it all comes together with a crash in his mind. There was never any Mr. Gray, not really. Mr. Gray lives in the dream catcher and nowhere else. He is no more real than the pain in his hip. I was immune, he thinks, getting up. I never got so much as a speck of the virus. What's in my head isn't quite a memory, not that, but a true ghost in the machine. He's me. Dear God, Mr. Gray is me. Jonesy scrambles to his feet and begins to run, almost losing his feet as he swerves around a corner. He stays up, though. He is agile and quick as only a 14-year-old can be, and there is no pain. No pain. The next corridor is one he knows. There is a parked gurney with a bedpan on it. Walking past it, moving delicately on tiny feet, is a deer he saw that day in Cambridge just before he was struck. There is a collar around its velvety neck, and swinging from it, like an oversized amulet, is his magic eight ball. Jonesy sprints past the deer, which looks at him with mild, surprised eyes.
Jonesy!
Close now, very close.
Jonesy! Hurry!
Jonesy redoubles his speed, feet flying, young lungs breathing easily. There is no virus because he is immune. There is no Mr. Gray, not in him at least. Mr. Gray is in the hospital and always was. Mr. Gray is the phantom limb you still feel, the one you could swear is still there. Mr. Gray is the ghost in the machine, the ghost on life support, and the life support is him. He turns another corner. Here are three doors which are standing open. Beyond them, by the fourth door, the only one that is closed, Henry is standing. Henry is 14, as Jonesy is. Henry is wearing an orange coat, as Jonesy is. His glasses have slid down on his nose, just as they always did, and he is beckoning urgently.
Hurry up! Hurry up, Jonesy! Duddits can't hold on much longer! If he dies before we kill Mr. Gray...
Jonesy joins Henry at the door. He wants to throw his arms around him, embrace him, but there's no time.
This is all my fault, he tells Henry,
and his voice is higher in pitch than it has been in years. Not true, Henry says. He is looking at Jonesy with the old impatience that awed Jonesy and Pete and Beaver as children. Henry always seemed further ahead, always on the verge of sprinting into the future and leaving the rest of them behind. They always seemed to be holding him back.
But you might as well say that Duddits murdered Richie Grenadol and that we were his accomplices.
He was what he was, Jonesy, and he made us what we are.
But not on purpose. It was all he could do to tie his shoes on purpose, don't you know that?
And Jonesy thinks,
fit what? Fit Neek?
Henry, is Duddits. He's holding on for us, Jonesy. I told you, he's holding us together. In the dream catcher. That's right. So are we going to stand out here arguing in the hall while the world goes down the chuter, or are we going to... We're going to kill the son of a bitch, Jonesy says, and reaches for the doorknob. Above it is a sign reading, There is no infection here. Il n'y a pas d'infection ici. And suddenly, he sees both of that sign's bitter edges. It's like one of those Escher optical illusions. Look at it from one angle, and it's true. Look at it from another, and it's the most monstrous lie in the universe. Dreamcatcher, Jonesy thinks, and turns the knob. The room beyond the door is a virus madhouse, a nightmare jungle overgrown with creepers and vines and lianas twisted together in blood-colored plates. The air reeks of sulfur and chili ethyl alcohol, the smell of starter fluid sprayed into a balky carb on a sub-zero January morning. At least they don't have the shit weasel to worry about, not in here. That's on another strand of the Dreamcatcher, in another place and time. The Byram is Lad's problem now. He's a border collie with a very dim future. The television is on, and although the screen is overgrown with virus, a ghostly black-and-white image comes straining through. A man is dragging the corpse of a dog across a concrete floor. Dusty and strewn with dead autumn leaves, it's like a tomb in one of the 50s horror flicks Jonesy still likes to watch on his VCR. But this isn't a tomb. It is filled with the hollow sound of rushing water. In the center of the floor, there is a rusty circular cover with MWRA stamped on it, Massachusetts Water Resources Authority. Even through the reddish scrum on the TV screen, these letters stand out. Of course they do. To Mr. Gray, who died as a physical being all the way back at Hole in the Wall, they mean everything. They mean, quite literally, the world. The shaft lid has been partly pushed aside, revealing a crescent shape of absolute darkness. The man dragging the dog is himself, Jonesy realizes. And the dog isn't quite dead. It is leaving a trail of frothy pink blood behind on the concrete, and its back legs are twitching, almost paddling. Never mind the movie, Henry almost snarls. And Jonesy turns his attention to the figure in the bed, the gray thing with the virus-speckled sheet pulled up to its chest, which is a plain gray expanse of poreless, hairless, nippleless flesh. Although he can't see now because of the sheet, Jonesy knows there is no navel either, because this thing was never born. It is a child's rendering of an alien, trolled directly from the subconscious minds of those who first came in contact with the Byram. They never existed as actual creatures, aliens, ETs. The Greys, as physical beings, were always created out of the human imagination, out of the dream catcher, and knowing this affords Jonesy a measure of relief. He wasn't the only one who got fooled. At least there is that. Something else pleases him. The look in those horrid black eyes. It's fear. I'm locked and loaded, Freddy said quietly, drawing to a stop behind the Humvee they had chased all these miles. Outstanding, Kurtz said. Recon that HMW, I'll cover you. Right. Freddy looked at Perlmutter, whose belly was swelling again, then at Owen's Hummer. The reason for the rifle fire they'd heard earlier was clear now. The Hummer had been shot up pretty good. The only question left to be answered was who had been on the giving end and who on the receiving. Tracks led away from the Hummer, growing indistinct under the rapid snowfall, but for now clear enough to read. A single set. Boots. Probably Owen. Go on now, Freddy. Freddy got out into the snow. Kurtz slid out behind him, and Freddy heard him rack the slide of his personal. Depending on the 9mm, well, maybe that was all right. He was good with it, no question of that. Freddy felt a momentary coldness down his spine, as if Kurtz had the 9 leveled there, right there. But that was ridiculous, wasn't it? Owen, yes, but Owen was different. Owen had crossed the line. Freddy hurried to the Hummer, bent low, carbine held at chest level. He didn't like having Kurtz behind him. That was undeniable. No, he didn't like that at all. As the two boys advance on the overgrown bed, Mr. Gray begins to push the call button repeatedly, but nothing happens. I think the works must be choked with virus, Jonesy thinks. Too bad, Mr. Gray. Too bad for you. He glances up at the TV and sees that his film self has gotten the dog to the edge of the shaft. Maybe they're too late after all. Maybe not. There's no way to tell. The wheel is still spinning. Hello, Mr. Gray. I've so much wanted to meet you, Henry says. As he speaks, he removes the virus-splotched pillow from beneath Mr. Gray's narrow, earless head. Mr. Gray tries to wriggle toward the other side of the bed, but Jonesy holds him in place, grasping the alien's child-thin arms. The skin in his hands is neither hot nor cold. It doesn't feel like skin at all, not really. It feels like nothing, he thinks, like a dream. Mr. Gray, Henry asks, this is how we say welcome to planet Earth. And he puts the pillow over Mr. Gray's face. Beneath Jonesy's hands, Mr. Gray begins to struggle and thrash. Somewhere a monitor begins to beep frantically, as if this creature actually has and that it has now stopped beating. Jonesy looks down at the dying monster and wishes only for this to be over. Mr. Gray got the dog to the side of the shaft he had partially uncovered. Coming up through the narrow black semicircle was the steady hollow rush of running water and a waft of dank, cold air. If it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. That from a box marked Shakespeare. The dog's rear legs were bicycling rapidly, and Mr. Gray could hear the wet sound of tearing flesh as the Byram thrust with one end and chewed with the other, forcing itself out. Beneath the dog's tail, the chittering had started, a sound like an angry monkey. He had to get it into the shaft before it could emerge. It did not absolutely have to be born in the water, but its odds of survival would be much higher if it was. Mr. Gray tried to shove the dog's head into the gap between the cover and the concrete and couldn't get it through. The neck bent, and the dog's senselessly grinning snout twisted upward. Although still sleeping, or perhaps it was now unconscious, it began to utter a series of low, choked barks. And it wouldn't go through the gap.
Fuck me, Freddy! Mr. Gray screamed.
He was barely aware of the snarling ache in Jonesy's hip now, certainly not aware that Jonesy's face was strained and pale, the hazel eyes wet with tears of effort and frustration. He was aware, terribly aware, that something was going on behind my back, Jonesy would have said. And who else could it be? Who else but Jonesy, his reluctant hope that the damned, hateful, stubborn, just a little too big dog. You're going down, do you hear me? Do you? The words stopped in his throat. All at once, he couldn't yell anymore, although he dearly wanted to. How he loved to yell and pound his fists on things, even a dying pregnant dog. All at once, he couldn't breathe, let alone yell. What was Jonesy doing to him? He expected no answer, but one came. A stranger's voice, full of cold rage. This is how we say welcome to planet Earth. The flailing, three-fingered hands of the gray thing in the hospital bed come up and actually push the pillow aside for a moment. The black eyes, starting from the otherwise featureless face, are frantic with fear and rage. It gasps for breath. Considering that it doesn't really exist at all, not even in Jonesy's brain, at least as a physical artifact, it is fighting furiously for its life. Henry cannot sympathize, but he understands. It wants what Jonesy wants, what Duditz wants, what even Henry himself wants. For in spite of all his black thoughts, has his heart not gone on beating? Has his liver not gone on washing his blood? Has his body not gone on fighting its unseen wars against everything from the common cold to cancer to the virus itself? The body is either stupid or infinitely wise, but in either case, it is spared the terrible witchery of thought. It only knows how to stand its ground and fight until it can fight no more. If Mr. Gray was ever any different, he is different no longer. He wants to live, and he wants to finish the job. But I don't think you will, Henry says in a voice that is calm, almost soothing. I don't think so, my friend. and once more puts the pillow over Mr. Gray's face. Mr. Gray's airway opened. He got one breath of the cold shaft house air, two, and then the airway closed up again. They were smothering him, stifling him, killing him.
No! Kiss my Benda! Kiss my fucking Benda! You can't do this!
He yanked the dog back and turned it sideways. It was almost like watching a man already late for his plane trying to make one last bulky article fit into his suitcase.
You'll go through this way, he thought.
Yes, it would, even if he had to collapse the dog's bulging middle with Jonesy's hands and allow the Byram to squirt free. One way or another, the damn thing would go through. Face swelling, eyes bulging, breath stopped, a single fat vein swelling in the middle of Jonesy's forehead, Mr. Gray shoved Lad deeper into the crack and then began to thump the dog's chest with Jonesy's fists.
Go through, damn you, through! Go through!
Freddie Johnson pointed his carbine inside the abandoned Hummer, while Kurtz, stationed shrewdly behind him, in that way it was like the attack on the Gray Boy ship all over again, waited to see what would develop. Two guys, boss. Looks like Owen decided to put out the trash before moving on.
Dead?
He looked pretty dead to me. Got to be Devlin and the one they stopped for. Kurtz joined Freddie, took a brief glance in through the shattered window, and nodded. They looked pretty dead to him, too, a pair of white moles lying entwined in the back seat, covered with blood and shattered glass. He raised his 9mm to make sure of them. One each in the head couldn't hurt. Then lowered it again. Owen might not have heard their engine. The snow was amazingly heavy and wet, an acoustical blanket, and that was very possible. But he would hear gunshots. He turned toward the path instead.
Lead the way, Buck, and mind the footing. Look slippery. And we may still have the element of surprise. I think we should bear that in mind, don't you?
Freddie nodded. Kurtz smiled. It turned his face into a skull's face.
With any luck, Buck, Owen Underhill will be in hell before he even knows he's dead.
The TV remote, a rectangle of black plastic covered with virus, is lying on Mr. Gray's bed table. Jonesy grabs it. In a voice that sounds eerily like Beaver's, he says, "Fuck this shit," and slams it down as hard as he can on the table's edge, like a man cracking the shell of a hard-boiled egg. The controller shatters, spilling its batteries and leaving a jagged plastic wand in Jonesy's hand. He reaches below the pillow Henry is holding over the thrashing thing's face. He hesitates for just a moment, remembering his first meeting with Mr. Gray, his only meeting. The bathroom knob coming free in his hand as the rod snapped. The sense of darkness, which was the creature's shadow, falling over him. It had been real enough then. Real as roses, real as raindrops. Jonesy had turned and seen him. It, whatever Mr. Gray had been before he was Mr. Gray, standing there in the big central room. The stuff of 100 movies and unexplained mysteries documentaries, only old. Old and sick. Ready even then for this hospital bed in the intensive care unit. Mercy, it had said, plucking the word straight out of Jonesy's brain, pulling it like a cork, making the hole through which it could enter. Then it had exploded like a noisemaker on New Year's Eve, spraying virus instead of confetti, and I imagined the rest. That was it, wasn't it? Just another case of intergalactic schizophrenia. Basically, that was it.
Jonesy, Henry shouts. If you're going to do it, then do it.
Here it comes, Mr. Gray, Jonesy thinks. Get ready for it, because paybacks. Mr. Gray had gotten Lad's body halfway into the gap when Jonesy's voice filled his head. Here it comes, Mr. Gray. Get ready for it, because paybacks a bitch. There was a ripping pain across the middle of Jonesy's throat. Mr. Gray raised Jonesy's hands, making a series of gagging grunts that would not quite attain the status of screams. He didn't feel the beard-stubbled, unbroken skin of Jonesy's throat, but his own ragged flesh. What he felt most strongly was shocked disbelief. It was the last of Jonesy's emotions upon which he drew. This could not be happening. They always came in the ships of the old ones, those artifacts, They always raised their hands in surrender. They always won. This could not be happening. And yet somehow it was. The Byram's consciousness did not so much fade as disintegrate. Dying, the entity once known as Mr. Gray reverted to its former state. As he became it, and just before it could become nothing, Mr. Gray gave the dog's body a final, vicious shove. It sank into the gap, yet still not quite far enough to go through. The Byram's last Jonesy-tinged thought was, I should have taken him up on it. I should have gone Jonesy slashes the jagged end of the TV controller across Mr. Gray's naked, wattled neck. Its throat peels open like a mouth, and a cloud of reddish-orange matter puffs out, staining the air the color of blood before falling back to the counterpane in a shower of dust and fluff. Mr. Gray's body twitches once, galvanically, beneath Jonesy's and Henry's hands. Then it shrivels, like the dream it always was, and becomes something familiar. For a moment, Jonesy can't make the connection, and then it comes. Mr. Gray's remains look like one of those condoms they saw on the floor of the deserted office in the Tracker Brothers Depot. He's dead, is how Jonesy means to finish. But then a terrible bolt of pain tears through him. Not his hip this time, but his head and his throat. All at once, his throat is wearing a necklace of fire. And the whole room is transparent, damned if it isn't. He's looking through the wall and into the shaft house where the dog, stuck in the crack, is giving birth to a vile red creature that looks like a weasel crossed with a huge, blood-soaked worm. He knows well enough what it is, one of the Byram. Streaked with blood and shit and the remains of its own membranous placenta, its brainless black eyes staring. They're his eyes, Jonesy thinks, Mr. Gray's eyes. It is being born in front of him, stretching its body out, trying to pull free, wanting to drop into the darkness and fall toward the sound of running water. Jonesy looks at Henry. Henry looks back. For just a moment, their young and startled eyes meet, and then they are disappearing as well. Duditz, Henry says. His voice comes from far away. Duditz is going. Jonesy. Goodbye. Perhaps Henry means to say goodbye. Before he can, they're both gone. There was a moment of vertigo when Jonesy was exactly nowhere, a sense of utter disconnection. He thought it must be death, that he had killed himself as well as Mr. Gray, cut his own throat, as the saying went. What brought him back was pain. Not in his throat, that was gone, and he could breathe again. He could hear the air going in and out of him in great dry gasps. No, this pain was an old acquaintance. It was in his hip. It caught him and swung him back into the world around its swollen, howling axis, winding him up like a tetherball on a post. There was concrete under his knees. His hands were full of fur, and he heard an inhuman chittering sound. At least this part is real, he thought. This part is outside the dream catcher. That god-awful chittering sound. Jonesy saw the weasel thing now dangling into the dark, held to the upper world only by its tail, which wasn't yet free of the dog. Jonesy lunged forward and clamped his hands around its slippery, shivering middle, just as it did pull free. He rocked backward, his bad hip throbbing, holding the writhing, yammering thing above his head like a carny performer with a boa constrictor. It whipped back and forth, teeth gnashing at the air, bending back on itself, trying to get at Jonesy's wrist and snagging the right sleeve of his parka instead, tearing it open and releasing near-weightless tangles of white down filling. Jonesy pivoted on his howling hip and saw a man framed in the broken window through which Mr. Gray had wriggled. The newcomer, his face long with surprise, was dressed in a camouflage parka and holding a rifle. Jonesy flung the wriggling weasel as hard as he could, which wasn't very hard. It flew perhaps 10 feet, landed on the leaf-littered floor with a wet thump, and immediately began slithering back toward the shaft. The dog's body plugged part of it, but not enough. There was plenty of room.
Shoot it!
Jonesy screamed at the man with the rifle. For God's sake, shoot it before it can get into the water! But the man in the window did nothing. The world's last hope only stood there with his mouth hanging open. Owen simply couldn't believe what he was seeing. Some sort of red thing, a freakish weasel with no legs. To hear about such things was one matter. To actually see one was another. It squirmed toward the hole in the middle of the floor. A dog with its stiffening paws held up as if in surrender was wedged there. The man, it had to be Typhoid Jonesy, was screaming at him to shoot the thing, but Owen's arms simply wouldn't come up. They seemed to be coated in lead. The thing was going to get away. After all that had happened, what he had hoped to prevent was going to happen right in front of him. It was like being in hell. He watched it wriggle forward, making a god-awful monkey sound that he seemed to hear in the center of his head. He watched Jonesy lunging with desperate awkwardness. It wasn't going to work. Dog was in the way. Owen ended his to raise the gun and point it, but nothing happened. The MP5 might as well have been in another universe. He was going to let it get away. He was going to stand here like a post and let it get away. God help him. God help them all. Henry sat up in the back seat of the Humvee, dazed. There was stuff in his hair. He brushed at it, still feeling caught in the dream of the hospital, except that was no dream, he thought. And then a sharp prick of pain restored him to something like reality. It was glass. His hair was filled with glass. More of it, safety glass crumbles of it, covered the seat and Duddits. Dud. Useless, of course. Duddits was dead. Must be dead. He had expended the last of his failing energy to bring Jonesy and Henry together in that hospital room. But Duddits groaned. His eyes opened, and looking into them brought Henry all the way back to this snowy dead-end road. Duddits's eyes were red and bloody zeros, the eyes of a sibyl. Ubi! Duddits cried. His hands rose and made a weak aiming gesture, as if he held a rifle.
Ubi do! At some urku do now!
From somewhere up ahead in the woods, two rifle shots came in answer. A pause, then a third one. Dud, Henry whispered. Duddits! Duddits saw him. Even through his bloody eyes, Duddits saw him. Henry more than felt this. For a moment, he actually saw himself through Duddits's eyes. It was like looking into a magic mirror. He saw the Henry who had been, a kid looking out at the world through horn-rimmed glasses that were too big for his face and always sliding down to the end of his nose. He felt Duddits's love for him, a simple and uncomplicated emotion, untinctured by doubt or selfishness or even gratitude. Henry took Duddits in his arms, and when he felt the lightness of his old friend's body, Henry began to cry. You were the lucky one, Bud, he said, and wished Beaver were here. Beaver could have done what Henry could not. Beave could have sung Duddits to sleep. You were always the lucky one. That's what I think.
Any,
Duddits said, and touched Henry's cheek with one hand. He was smiling, and his final words were perfectly clear.
I love you, Annie.
Two shots rang out up ahead. Carbine whip cracks. Not far up ahead, either. Kurtz stopped. Freddy was about 20 feet ahead of him, standing by a sign Kurtz could just make out. Absolutely no fishing from Shaft House. A third shot. Then silence.
Boss? Freddy murmured. Some kind of building up ahead. Can you see anyone?
Freddy shook his head. Kurtz joined him, amused, even at this point, at the slight jump Freddy gave when Kurtz put his hand on Freddy's shoulder. And he was right to jump. If Abe Kurtz survived the next 15 or 20 minutes, he intended to go forward alone into whatever brave new world there might be. No one to slow him down, no witnesses to this final guerrilla action. And while he might suspect, Freddy couldn't know for sure. Too bad that telepathy was gone. Too bad for Freddy.
Sounds like Owen found someone else to kill.
Kurt spoke low into Freddy's ear, which still sported a few curls of the Ripley, now white and dead. Do we go get him?
Goodness, no, Kurtz replied. Perish the thought. I believe the time has come. Regrettably, it comes in almost every life when we must step off the path, Buck. Mingle with the trees. See who stays and who comes back. If anyone does, we'll give it 10 minutes, shall we? I think 10 minutes should be more than enough. The words which filled Owen Underhill's mind were nonsensical, but unmistakable. Scooby, Scooby-Doo, got some work to do now. The carbine came up. He wasn't the one who did it, but when the force lifting the rifle left him, Owen was able to take over smoothly. He flicked the auto's selector switch to single-shot fire, sighted, and squeezed the trigger twice. The first round missed, hitting the concrete in front of the weasel and ricocheting. Chips of concrete flew. The thing pulled back, turned, saw him, and bared its mouthful of needle teeth. "That's right, beautiful," Owen said. "Smile for the camera." His second shot went right through the weasel's humorless grin. It tumbled backward, struck the wall of the shaft house, then fell to the concrete. Yet even with its rudiment of a head blown off, its instincts remained. It began to crawl slowly forward again. Owen aimed, and as he centered the sight, he thought of the Rapallos, Dick and Irene. Nice people. Good neighbors. If you needed a cup of sugar or a pint of milk, or a shoulder to cry on for that matter, you could always go next door and get fixed up. "They said it was a stroke," Mr. Rapallo had called. Only Owen had thought he was saying stork. Kids got everything wrong. So this was for the Rapallos, and for the kid who had kept getting it wrong. Owen fired a third time. This slug caught the Byram amidships and tore it in two. The ragged pieces twitched, twitched, lay still. With that done, Owen swung his carbine in a short arc. This time, he settled the sight on the middle of Gary Jones's forehead. Jonesy looked unblinkingly back at him. Owen was tired, almost to death, that was what it felt like, but this guy looked far past even that point. Jonesy raised his empty hands. "You have no reason to believe this," he said, "but Mr. Gray is dead. I cut his throat while Henry held a pillow over his face. It was right out of The Godfather." "Really?" Owen said. There was no inflection in his voice whatsoever. "And where exactly did you perform this execution?" "In a Massachusetts General Hospital of the Mind," Jonesy said. He then uttered the most joyless laugh Owen had ever heard in his life. "When we're deer roam the halls, and the only TV program is an old movie called Sympathy for the Devil." Owen jerked a little at that. "Shoot me if you have to, soldier. I saved the world with a little ninth-inning relief help from you, I freely admit. You might as well pay me for the service in the traditional manner. Also, the bastard broke my hip again. A little going-away present from the little man who wasn't there. The pain is..." Jonesy bared his teeth. "It's very large." Owen held the gun where it was a moment longer, then lowered it. "You can live with it," he said. Jonesy fell backward on the points of his elbows, groaned, turned his weight as well as he could onto his unhurt side. "Duditz is dead. He was worth both of us put together. More. And he's dead." He covered his eyes for a moment, then dropped his arm. "Man, what a fuck-a-row this is. That's what Beaver would have called it, a total fuck-a-row. That is opposed to a fuckeree, you understand, which in Beaverese means a particularly fine time. Possibly, but not necessarily, of a sexual nature." Owen had no idea what the man was talking about. Likely, he was delirious. "Duditz may be dead, but Henry's not. There are some people after us, Jonesy. Bad people. Do you hear them? Know where they are?" Lying on the cold, leaf-littered floor, Jonesy shook his head. "I'm back to the standard five senses, I'm afraid. ESP's all gone. The Greeks may come bearing gifts, but they're Indian givers." He laughed. "Jesus, I could lose my job for a crack like that. Sure you don't want to just shoot me?" Owen paid no more attention to this than he had to the semantical differences between fuck-a-row and fuckeree. Kurtz was coming. That was the problem he had to deal with now. He hadn't heard him arrive, but he might not have done. The snow was falling heavily enough to damp all but loud sounds. Gunshots, for instance. I have to go back to the road, he said. You hang in there. What choice? Jonesy asked, and closed his eyes. Man, I wish I could go back to my nice warm office. I never thought I'd say that, but there it is. Owen turned and went back down the steps, slipping and sliding, but managing to keep his feet. He scanned the woods to either side of the path, but not closely. If Kurtz and Freddy were laid up, waiting someplace between here and the Hummer, he doubted he would see them in time to do anything. He might see tracks, but by then, he'd be so close to them, they'd likely be the last things he saw. He had to hope he was still ahead, that was all. Had to trust to plain old bald-ass luck, and why not? He'd been in plenty of tight places, and bald-ass luck had always pulled him through. Maybe it would do so again. The first bullet took him in the belly, knocking him backward and blowing the back of his coat out in a bell shape. He pumped his feet, trying to stay upright, also trying to hang on to the MP5. There was no pain, just a feeling of having been sucker-punched by a large boxing glove on the fist of a mean opponent. The second round shaved the side of his head, producing a burn and sting like rubbing alcohol poured into an open wound. The third shot hit him high up on the right side of the chest, and that was Katie by the door. He lost both his feet and the carbine. What had Jonesy said? Something about having saved the world and getting paid off in the traditional manner? And this wasn't so bad, really. It had taken Jesus 6 hours. They'd put a joke sign over his head, and come cocktail hour, they'd given him a stiff vinegar and water. He lay half on and half off the snow-covered path, vaguely aware that something was screaming, and it wasn't him. It sounded like an enormous pissed-off blue jay. That's an eagle, Owen thought. He managed to get a breath, and although the exhale was more blood than air, he was able to get up on his elbows. He saw two figures emerge from the tangle of birches and pines, bent low, very much in combat advance mode. One was squat and broad-shouldered, the other slim and gray-haired and positively perky. Johnson and Kurtz, the bulldog and the greyhound. His luck had run out after all. In the end, luck always did. Kurtz knelt beside him, eyes sparkling. In one hand, he held a triangle of newspaper. It was battered and slightly curved from its long trip in Kurtz's rear pocket, but still recognizable. It was a cocked hat, a fool's hat. Tough luck, Buck, Kurtz said. Owen nodded. It was very tough luck. See, you found time to make me a little something.
I did, laddie. Did you achieve your prime objective at least?
Kurtz lifted his chin in the direction of the shaft house.
Got him, Owen managed.
His mouth was full of blood. He spat it out, tried to pull in another breath, and heard the good part of it wheeze out of some new hole instead.
Well, then, Kurtz said benevolently, all's well that ends well, wouldn't you say?
He put the newspaper hat tenderly on Owen's head. Blood soaked it immediately, spreading upward, turning the UFO story red. There was another scream from somewhere out over the reservoir, perhaps from one of the islands that were actually hills poking up from a purposely drowned landscape.
That's an eagle, Kurtz said, and patted Owen's shoulder. Count yourself lucky, laddie. God sent you a warbird to sing you to...
Kurtz's head exploded in a spray of blood and brains and bone. Owen saw one final expression in the man's blue, white-lashed eyes. Amazed disbelief. For a moment, Kurtz remained on his knees, then toppled forward on what remained of his face. Behind him, Freddy Johnson stood with his carbine still raised and smoke drifting from the muzzle. Freddy, Owen tried to say. No sound came out, but Freddy must have read his lips. He nodded. Didn't want to, but the bastard was going to do it to me. Didn't have to read his mind to know that, not after all these years. Finish it, Owen tried to say. Freddy nodded again. Perhaps there was a vestige of that goddamn telepathy left inside Freddy after all. Owen was fading, tired and fading. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night, David. Good night, Chet. Good night, sweet prince. He lay back on the snow, and it was like falling back into a bed stuffed with the softest down. From somewhere, faint and far, he heard the eagle scream again. They had invaded its territory, disturbed its snowy autumn peace, but soon they would be gone. The eagle would have the reservoir to itself again. We were heroes, Owen thought, damned if we weren't. Fuck your hat, Kurtz, we were hit. He never heard the final shot. There had been more firing. Now there was silence. Henry sat in the back seat of the Humvee beside his dead friend, trying to decide what to do next. The chances that they had all killed each other seemed slim. The chances that the good guys, correction, the good guy, had taken out the bad ones seemed slimmer still. His first impulse following this conclusion was to vacate the Hummer post-haste and hide in the woods. Then he looked at the snow. If I ever see snow again, he thought, it'll be too soon, and rejected the idea. If Kurtz or whoever was with him came back in the next half hour, Henry's tracks would still be there. They would follow his trail, and at the end of it, they'd shoot him like a rabid dog or a weasel. Get a gun, then. Shoot them before they can shoot you. A better idea. He was no Wyatt Earp, but he could shoot straight. Shooting men was a lot different from shooting deer. He didn't have to be a head shrinker to know that, but he believed, given a clear line of fire, he could shoot these guys with very little hesitation. He was reaching for the door handle when he heard a surprised curse, a thump, yet another gunshot. This one was very close. Henry thought someone had lost his footing and gone down in the snow, discharging his weapon when he landed on his ass. Perhaps the son of a bitch had just shot himself. Was that too much to hope for? Wouldn't that just... But no, no joy. Henry heard a low grunt as the person who'd fallen got up and came on again. There was only one option, and Henry took it. He lay back down on the seat, put Duditz's arms around him again as best he could, and played dead. He didn't think there was much chance this hugger-mugger would work. The bad guys had passed by on their way in, obviously as he was still alive, but on their way in, they must have been in a pants-ripping hurry. Now they would be a lot less likely to be fooled by a few bullet holes, some broken glass, and the blood of poor old Duditz's final hemorrhages. Henry heard soft, crunching footsteps in the snow, only one set by the sound, probably the infamous Kurtz. Last man standing. Darkness approaching. Death in the afternoon. No longer his old friend. Now he was only playing dead, but approaching just the same. Henry closed his eyes. Waited. The footsteps passed the Humvee without slowing. Freddie Johnson's strategic goal was, for the time being, both extremely practical and extremely short-term. He wanted to get the goddamn Hummer turned around without getting stuck. If he managed that, he wanted to get past the break in East Street where the Subaru Owen had been chasing had come to grief without getting ditched himself. If he made it back to the access road, he might widen his horizons a trifle. The idea of the Mass Pike surfaced briefly in his mind as he swung open the door of the boss's Hummer and slid behind the wheel. There was a lot of Western America down I-90, a lot of places to hide. The stench of stale farts and chili ethyl alcohol struck him like a slap as he swung the door closed. Pearly, goddamn Pearly. In the excitement, he had forgotten all about that little motherfucker. Freddie turned, raising the carbine, but Pearly was still out cold. No need to use another bullet, he could just tip Perlmutter out into the snow. If he was lucky, Pearly would freeze to death without ever waking up. Him and his little sidekick... Pearly wasn't sleeping, though. Nor out cold. Nor in a coma. Not even that. Pearly was dead. And he was shrunken somehow. Almost mummified. His cheeks were drawn in, hollow, wrinkled. The sockets of his eyes were deep divots, as if behind the thin veils of his closed lids the eyeballs had fallen into what was now a hollow bucket. And he was tilted strangely against the passenger door, one leg raised, almost crossed over the other. It was as if he had died trying to perform the ever-popular one-cheek sneak. His fatigue pants were now dark, the muted colors turned to mud, and the seat under him was wet. The fingers of the stain spreading toward Freddy were red. What the fuck? From the back seat there arose an ear-splitting yammering. It was like listening to a powerful stereo turned rapidly up to full volume. Freddy caught movement from the corner of his right eye. A creature beyond belief appeared in the rearview mirror. It tore off Freddy's ear and then struck at his cheek, punched through into his mouth, and latched onto his jaw at the inner gum line. And then Archie Perlmutter's shitweasel tore off the side of Freddy's face as a hungry man might tear a drumstick off a chicken. Freddy shrieked and discharged his weapon into the passenger door of the Hummer. He got an arm up, tried to shove the thing off. His fingers slipped on its slick newborn skin. The weasel withdrew, tossed its head back, and swallowed what it had torn off like a parrot with a piece of raw steak. Freddy flailed for the driver's side door handle and found it, but before he could yank it up, the thing struck again, this time burying its mouth in the muscular flesh where Freddy's neck and shoulder merged. There was a vast jet of blood as his jugular opened. It spurted up to the Humvee's roof, then began to drip back like red rain. Freddy's feet jittered, bopping the Humvee's wide brake in a rapid tap dance. The creature in the back seat drew back again, seemed to consider, then slithered snake-like over Freddy's shoulder. It dropped into his lap. Freddy screamed once as the weasel tore off his plumbing, and then he screamed no more. Henry sat twisted around in the back seat of the other Humvee, watching as the figure in the vehicle parked behind him jerked back and forth behind the wheel. Henry was glad of the thickly falling snow, equally glad of the blood that sprayed up, striking the windshield of the other Humvee, partially obscuring the view. He could see all too well as it was. At last, the figure behind the wheel stopped moving and fell sideways. A bulky shadow rose over it, seeming to hulk in triumph. Henry knew what it was. He'd seen one on Jonesy's bed back at Hole in the Wall. One thing he could see was that there was a broken window in the Humvee which had been chasing them. He doubted if the thing had much in the way of intelligence, but how much would it need to register fresh air? They don't like the cold. It kills them. Yes, indeed it did. But Henry had no intention of leaving it at that, and not just because the reservoir was so close he could hear the water lapping on the rocks. Something had run up an extremely high debt, and only he was left to present the bill. Payback's a bitch, as Jonesy had so often observed, and payback time had arrived. He leaned over the seat. No weapons there. He leaned over further and thumbed open the glove compartment. Nothing in there but a litter of invoices, gasoline receipts, and a tattered paperback titled How to Be Your Own Best Friend. Henry opened the door, got out into the snow, and his feet immediately flew out from under him. He went on his butt with a thump and scraped his back on the Hummer's high splashboard. Fuck me, Freddy. He got up, slipped again, grabbed the top of the open door, and managed to stay afoot this time. He shuffled his feet around to the back of the vehicle he'd come in, never taking his eyes from its twin end. He could still see the thing inside thrashing and shuffling, dining on the driver. Stay where you are, beautiful, Henry said, and began to laugh. The laughter sounded crazy as hell, but that didn't stop him. Lay a few eggs. I am the Eggman, after all, your friendly neighborhood Eggman. Well, how about a copy of How to Be Your Own Best Friend? I got one. Laughing so hard now he could barely speak, sliding in the wet and treacherous snow like a kid let out of school and on his way to the nearest sledding hill. Holding onto the flank of the Hummer as best he could, except there was really nothing to hold onto once you were south of the doors, watching the thing shift and move. And then he couldn't see it anymore. Uh-oh. Where the hell had it gotten to? In one of Jonesy's dopey movies, this is where the scary music would start, Henry thought. Attack of the killer shit weasels. That got him laughing again. He was around to the back of the vehicle now. There was a button you could push to unlatch the rear window. Unless, of course, it was locked. Probably wasn't, though. Hadn't Owen gotten into the back this way? Henry couldn't remember. Couldn't for the life of him. He was clearly not being his own best friend. Still cackling, fresh tears gushing out of his eyes, he thumbed the button, and the back window popped open. Henry yanked it wider and looked in. Guns, thank God. Army carbines like the one that Owen had taken on his last patrol. Henry grabbed one and examined it. Safety, check. Fire selection switch, check. Clip marked U.S. Army 5.56 Cal 120 rounds, check. So simple, even a Byram can do it, Henry said, and laughed some more. He bent over, holding his stomach and slipping around in the slop, trying not to fall again. His legs ached, his back ached, his heart ached most of all, and still he laughed. He was the Eggman. He was the Eggman. He was the laughing hyena. He walked around to the driver's side of Kurtz's Humvee, gun raised, safety in what he devoutly hoped was the off position. Spooky music playing in his head, but still laughing. There was the gasoline hatch. No mistaking that. But where was Gamera, the terror from beyond space? As if it had heard his thought, and Henry realized that was perfectly likely, the weasel smashed headfirst against the rear window, the one that was, thankfully, unbroken. Its head was smeared with blood, hair, and bits of flesh. Its dreadful sea-grape eyes stared into Henry's. Did it know it had a way out, an escape hatch? Perhaps. And perhaps it understood that using it would likely mean a quick death. It bared its teeth. Henry Devlin, who had once won the American Psychiatric Association's Compassionate Caring Award for a New York Times op-ed piece called The End of Hate, bared his own in return. It felt good. Then he gave it the finger for Beaver and for Pete. That felt good, too. When he raised the carbine, the weasel, stupid perhaps, but not utterly stupid, dove out of sight. That was cool. Henry had never had the slightest intention of trying to shoot it through the window. He did like the idea of it down there on the floor, though. Close to the gas as you want to get, darling, he thought. He thumbed the carbine selector switch to full auto and fired a long burst into the gas tank. The sound of the gun was deafening. A huge, ragged hole appeared where the gasoline port had been, but for a moment, there was nothing else. So much for the Hollywood version of how shit like this works, Henry thought, and then heard a hoarse whisper of sound rising to a throaty hiss. He took two steps backward, and his feet shot out from under him again. This time, falling quite likely saved his eyesight and perhaps his life. The back of Kurtz's Humvee exploded only a second later, fire lashing out from underneath in big yellow petals. The rear tires jumped out of the snow. Glass sprayed through the snowy air, all of it going over Henry's head. Then the heat began to bake him, and he crawled away rapidly, dragging the carbine by its strap and laughing wildly. There was a second explosion, and the air was filled with whirling hooks of shrapnel. Henry got to his feet like a man climbing a ladder, using the lower branches of a handy tree as rungs. He stood, panting and laughing, legs aching, back aching, neck with an odd sprung feeling. The entire back half of Kurtz's Humvee was engulfed in flames. He could hear the thing inside, chittering furiously as it burned. He made a wide circle to the passenger side of the blazing Humvee and aimed the carbine at the broken window. He stood there for a moment, frowning, then realized why this seemed so stupid. All the windows in the Humvee were broken now, all the glass but the windshield. He began to laugh again. What a dork he was, what a total dork. Through the hell of flames in the Humvee's cabin, he could still see the weasel lurching back and forth like a drunk. How many rounds did he have left in the clip if the fucking thing did come out? 50? 20? 5? However many rounds there were, it would have to be enough. He wouldn't risk retreating to Owen's Humvee for another clip. But the thing never came out. Henry stood guard for 5 minutes, then stretched it to 10. The snow fell, and the Humvee burned, pouring black smoke into the white sky. Henry stood there, thinking of the Derry Days parade, and here come a tall man on stilts, here come the legendary cowboy, and how excited Duddits had been, jumping right up and down. Thinking of Pete, standing outside DJHS, hands cupped, pretending to smoke, waiting for the rest of them. Pete, whose plan had been to captain NASA's first manned Mars expedition. Thinking of Beaver and his Fonzie jacket, Beave and his toothpicks, Beave singing to Duddits, "Baby's boat's a silver dream." Beave hugging Jonesy at Jonesy's wedding and saying Jonesy had to be happy. He had to be happy for all of them. Jonesy. When Henry was absolutely sure the weasel was dead, incinerated, he started up the path to see if Jonesy was still alive. He didn't hold out much hope of that, but he discovered that he hadn't given up hope either. Only pain pinned Jonesy to the world, and at first he thought the haggard, sooty-cheeked man kneeling beside him had to be a dream or a final figment of his imagination, because the man appeared to be Henry. "Jonesy? Hey, Jonesy, are you there?" Henry snapped his fingers in front of Jonesy's eyes. "Earth to Jonesy. Henry? Is it you? Is it really?" "It's me," Henry said. He glanced at the dog, still partly stuck in the crack at the top of Shaft 12, then back at Jonesy. He brushed Jonesy's sweat-soaked hair off his forehead with infinite tenderness.
"Man, it took you,"
Jonesy began. And then the world wavered. He closed his eyes, concentrated hard, then opened them again.
"Took you long enough to get back from the store. Did you remember the bread?"
"Yeah, but I lost the hot dogs."
"What a fucking pisser."
Jonesy took a long and wavering breath.
"I'll go myself next time."
"Kiss my bender, pal," Henry said. And Jonesy slipped into darkness, smiling.
Epilogue, Labor Day. The universe, she is a bitch. Norman MacLean.
Another summer down the tubes, Henry thought. There was nothing sad about the thought, though. Summer had been good, and fall would be good, too. No hunting this year, and there would undoubtedly be the occasional visit from his new military friends. His new military friends wanted to be sure, above all things, that he wasn't growing any red foliage on his skin. But fall would be good just the same. Cool air, bright days, long nights. Sometimes in the post-midnight hours of his nights, Henry's old friend still came to visit. But when it did, he simply sat up in his study with a book in his lap and waited for it to go again. Eventually, it always did. Eventually, the sun always came up. The sleep you didn't get one night sometimes came to you on the next. And then it came like a lover. This was something he'd learned since last November. He was drinking a beer on the porch of Jonesy and Carla's cottage in Ware, the one on the shore of Pepper Pond. The south end of the Quabbin Reservoir was about 4 miles northwest of where he sat, and East Street, of course. The hand holding the can of Coors had only 3 fingers. He'd lost the 2 on the end to frostbite, perhaps while skiing out the deep-cut road from Hole in the Wall, perhaps while dragging Jonesy back to the remaining Humvee on a lashed-together travois. Last fall had been his season to drag people through the snow, it seemed, and with mixed results. Near the little scrap of beach, Carla Jones was tending a barbecue. Noel, the baby, was toddling around the picnic table to her left, diaper sagging. He was waving a charred hot dog cheerily in one hand. The other 3 Jones kids, ranging in ages from 11 to 3, were in the water, splashing around and yelling at each other. Henry supposed there might be some value to that biblical imperative about being fruitful and multiplying, but it seemed to him that Jonesy and Carla had taken it to absurd lengths. Behind him, the screen door clapped. Jonesy came out carrying a bucket filled with iced beers. His limp wasn't all that bad. This time the doc had just said fuck the original equipment and had replaced the whole thing with steel and Teflon. It would have come to that anyway, the doc had told Jonesy, but if you'd been a little more careful, Chief, you could have gotten another 5 years out of the old one. He'd had the operation in February, shortly after Henry and Jonesy's 6-week vacation with the military intelligence and psyops people had ended. The military folks had offered to throw in the hip replacement courtesy of Uncle Sam, sort of a coda to their debriefing, but Jonesy had refused with thanks, saying he wouldn't want to deprive his own orthopedist of the work or his insurance company of the bill. By then, all the 2 of them had wanted was to get out of Wyoming. The apartments were nice, if you could get used to living underground, that was. The food was 4-star. Jonesy put on 10 pounds, Henry close to 20, and the movies were always first run. The atmosphere, however, was just a teensy bit on the Dr. Strangelove side. For Henry, Those 6 weeks had been infinitely worse than they had been for Jonesy. Jonesy suffered, but mostly with his derailed hip. His memories of sharing a body with Mr. Gray had faded to the consistency of dreams in a remarkably short space of time. Henry's memories, on the other hand, had only grown stronger. Those of the barn were the worst. The debriefers had been compassionate, not a Kurtz in the bunch, but Henry couldn't block his thoughts of Bill and Marcia and Darren Chiles, Mr. Bomber Joint from Newton. They often came to visit in his dreams. So did Owen Underhill. "Reinforcements," Jonesy said, setting the bucket of beer down. He then lowered himself into the sagging, cane-bottomed rocker beside Henry with a grunt and a grimace. "One more and I'm done," Henry said. "I'm driving back to Portland in an hour or so, and an OUI I don't need." "Stay the night," Jonesy said, watching Noel. The baby had plumped down on the grass beneath the picnic table and now seemed intent upon inserting the remains of his hot dog into his navel. "With your kids squabbling their way toward midnight and maybe beyond," Henry asked, "getting my pick of Mario Bava horror movies?" "I pretty well signed off the fright flicks," Jonesy said. "We're having a Kevin Costner festival tonight, starting with The Bodyguard." "I thought you said no horror movies." "Smartass." Then he shrugged, grinned. "Whatever you feel." Henry raised his beer can. "Here's to absent friends." Jonesy raised his own. "Absent friends." They clinked cans and drank. "How's Roberta?" Jonesy asked. Henry smiled. "Doing very well. I had my doubts at the funeral." Jonesy nodded. At Duddett's funeral, they had flanked her, and that had been a good thing because Roberta had hardly been able to stand on her own. "But now she's coming on strong. Talking about opening a craft shop. I think that's a good idea. Of course, she misses him. After Alfie died, Duds was her life." "He was ours, too," Jonesy said. "Yes, I suppose he was." "I feel so bad about the way we left him on his own all those years. I mean, he had leukemia and we didn't even fucking know." "Sure, we knew," Henry said. Jonesy looked at him, eyebrows raised. "Hey, Henry," Carla called. "How do you want your burger?" "Cooked," he yelled back. "I will make it so, sire. Would you be a love and get the baby? That hot dog's rapidly turning into a dirt dog. Take it away from him and give him to his dad." Henry went down the steps, fished Noel out from under the table, and carried him back toward the porch. "Annie," Noel cried brightly. He was now 18 months old. Henry stopped, feeling a chill spread up his back. It was as if he had been hailed by a ghost.
"Ifu, Annie, ifu."
Noel bopped Henry briskly on the nose with his dirt dog to underline the thrust of his thesis. "I'll wait for my burger, thanks," he said, and resumed walking.
"No e my foo?"
"Any e his own foo, honey bunch. But maybe I ought to have that nasty thing. You can have another one as soon as they're ready." He tweezed the dirt dog out of Noel's little hand, then plumped him down in Jonesy's lap and resumed his seat. By the time Jonesy had finished swabbing mustard and ketchup out of his son's belly button, the kid was almost asleep.
"What do you mean, sure we knew?" Jonesy asked.
"Ah, Jonesy, come on. Maybe we left him or tried. But do you think Duddett's ever left us? After all that happened, do you really believe that?" Very slowly, Jonesy shook his head. "Some of it was growing up, growing apart. But some of it was the Richie Grenado thing. That worked on us, the way the business of the Rapallo's serving platter worked on Owen Underhill." Jonesy didn't need to ask what this meant. In Wyoming, they'd had all the time they needed to catch up on each other's story.
"There's an old poem about a man trying to outrun God," Henry said. "The Hound of Heaven, it's called. Duddett's wasn't God, God forbid, but he was our hound. We ran as fast and as far as we could, but we could never run off the dreamcatcher, could we?" Jonesy said. "None of us could do that. And then they came, the Byram. Stupid spores in spaceships built by some other race. Is that what they were? All they were? I don't think we'll ever know. Only one question got answered last fall. For centuries, we've looked up at the stars and asked ourselves if we're alone in the universe. Well, now we know we're not. Big whoop, huh? Gerritsen. Do you remember Gerritsen?" Jonesy nodded. Of course he remembered Terry Gerritsen.
Navy psychologist in charge of the Wyoming debriefing team, always joking about how typical it was that Uncle Sammy would post him to a place where the nearest water was Lars Kilborn's cow wallow. Gerritsen and Henry had become close, if not quite friends, only because the situation didn't quite allow it. Jonesy and Henry had been well treated in Wyoming, but they hadn't been guests. Still, Henry Devlin and Terry Gerritsen were professional colleagues, and such things made a difference. Gerritsen started by assuming two questions had been answered, that we're not alone in the universe, and that we're not the only intelligent beings in the universe. I labored hard to convince him that the second postulate was based on faulty logic, a house built on sand. I don't think I entirely succeeded in getting through, but I may have planted a seed of doubt at least. Whatever else the Byram may be, they are not shipbuilders, and the race that built the ships may be gone, may in fact be Byram themselves by now. Mr. Gray wasn't stupid. Not once he got inside your head, that much I agree with. Mr. Gray was you, Jonesy. He stole your emotions, your memories, your taste for bacon. I don't need it anymore. I'm not surprised. He also stole your basic personality. That included the subconscious kinks. Whatever there is in you that liked the Mario Bava horror movies and the Sergio Leone westerns, whatever it is that got off on the fear and the violence, man, Mr. Gray loved that shit. And why wouldn't he? Those things are primitive survival tools. As the last of his kind in a hostile environment, he grabbed every damn tool he could lay his hands on. Bullshit. Jonesy's dislike of this idea was plain on his face. It's not. At Hole in the Wall, you saw what you expected to see, which was an X-Files / Close Encounters of the Third Kind alien. You inhaled the virus. I have no doubt that there was at least that much physical contact, but you were completely immune to it. As we now know, at least 50% of the human race seems to be. What you caught was an intention, a kind of blind imperative. Fuck, there's no word for it because there's no word for them. But I think it got in because you believed it was there. You are telling me, Jonesy said, looking at Henry over the top of his sleeping son's head, that I almost destroyed the human race because I had a hysterical pregnancy? Oh, no, Henry said. If that had been all, it would have passed off, would have amounted to no more than a fugue. But in you, the idea of Mr. Gray stuck like a fly in a spiderweb. It stuck in the dream catcher. Yes. They fell quiet. Soon Carla would call them, and they would eat hot dogs and hamburgers, potato salad and watermelon, beneath the blue shield of the infinitely permeable sky. And will you say it was all coincidence, Jonesy asked? That they just happened to come down in Jefferson Tract, and I just happened to be there? And not just me either, you and Peter and Beav, plus Duddits, just a couple of 100 miles to the south, don't forget that. Because it was Duddits who held us together. Duddits was always a sword with two edges, Henry said. Josie Rinkenauer on one, Duddits the finder, Duddits the savior. Richie Grenadeau on the other, Duddits the killer. Only Duddits needed us to help him kill his lair. We supplied the hate and the fear that Richie really would get us the way he promised he would. We always had more of the dark stuff than Duds. His idea of being mean was counting your crib backwards, and that was more in the spirit of fun than anything else. Still, do you remember the time Pete pulled Duddits's hat over his eyes and Duds walked into the wall? Jonesy did, vaguely, out at the mall that had been, when they had been young and the mall had been the place to go. Same shit, different day. For quite a while after that, Pete lost whenever we played the Duddits game. Duddits always counted him backward, and none of us tipped to it. We probably thought it was just coincidence, but in light of everything I know now, I tend to doubt that. You think even Duddits knew payback's a bitch? He learned it from us, Jonesy. Duddits gave Mr. Gray his foothold, his mind hold. Yeah, but he also gave you a stronghold, a place where you could hide from Mr. Gray. Don't forget that. No, Jonesy thought. He would never forget that. All of it on our end started with Duddits, Henry said. We've been odd, Jonesy, ever since we knew him. You know it's true. The things with Richie Grenadeau were only the big things, the ones that stood out. If you look back over your life, you'll see other things, I'm sure of it.
Dufuniak,
Jonesy murmured. Who's that?
The kid I caught cheating just before my accident. I caught him even though I wasn't there on the day the test was given.
You see? But in the end, it was Duddits who broke the little gray son of a bitch. I'll tell you something else. I think Duddits saved my life at the end of East Street. I think it's entirely possible that when Kurtz's sidekick looked into the back of the Humvee at us, the first time I'm talking about, he had a little Duddits in his head saying, "Don't worry, old hoss, go on about your business, they're dead." But Jonesy had not left his earlier thought. And are we supposed to believe that the Byram connecting with us, of all the people in the world, was just random coincidence? Because that's what Gerritsen believed. He never said it in so many words, but his take on it was clear enough. Why not? There are scientists, brilliant men like Stephen Jay Gould, who believe that our own species exists thanks to an even longer and more improbable chain of coincidences. Is that what you believe? Henry lifted his hands. He hardly knew how to reply without invoking God, who had crept back into his life over these last few months, by the back door, as it were, and in the dead of many sleepless nights. But did one have to invoke that old Deus Ex Machina to make sense of this? What I believe is that Duddits is us, Jonesy. L'enfant, c'est moi, toi, tout le monde. Race, species, genus, game, set, and match. We are, in our sum, Duddits. And all our noblest aspirations come down to no more than keeping track of the yellow lunchbox and learning to put our shoes on the right way. Fais-moi, fit-nique. Our wickedest motions, in a cosmic sense, come down to no more than counting someone's crib, pegging it backwards, then playing dumb about it. Jonesy was regarding him with fascination. That's either inspiring or horrible, I can't tell which. And it doesn't matter. Jonesy thought about this, then asked, if we are Duddits, who sings to us? Who sings the lullaby, helps us go to sleep when we're sad and scared? Oh, God still does that, Henry said, and could have kicked himself. There it was, out in spite of all his intentions. And did God keep that last weasel out of Shaft 12? Because if that thing had gotten into the water, Henry... Technically, the weasel that had incubated inside of Perlmutter had actually been the last, but it was a fine point, a hair that needed no splitting. It would have caused trouble, I don't dispute that. For a couple of years, whether or not to tear down Fenway Park would have been the least of Boston's concerns. But destroy us? I don't think so. We were a new thing to them. Mr. Gray knew it. Those tapes of you under hypnosis, don't talk about those. Jonesy had listened to two of them, and believed doing so had been the biggest mistake he'd made during his time in Wyoming. Listening to himself speak as Mr. Gray, under deep hypnosis to become Mr. Gray, had been like listening to a malevolent ghost. There were times when he thought he might be the only man on earth who truly understood what it was to be raped. Some things were better forgotten. Sorry. Jonesy waved his hand to show it was okay, not a problem, but he had paled considerably. All I'm saying is that, to a greater or lesser degree, we are a species living in the dreamcatcher. I hate the way that sounds. Phony transcendentalism rings in the ear like pure tin, but we don't have the right words for this part of it either. We may have to invent some eventually, but in the meantime, dreamcatcher will have to do. Henry turned in his seat. Jonesy did the same, shifting Noel a little bit on his lap. A dreamcatcher hung over the door to the cabin. Henry had brought it as a house present, and Jonesy had put it up at once, like a Catholic peasant nailing a crucifix to the door of his cottage during a time of vampires. Maybe they were just drawn to you, Henry said. To us? The way flowers turn to follow the sun, or the way iron filings line up when they feel the pull of a magnet. We can't tell for sure, because the Byram is so different from us. Will they be back? Oh, yes, Henry said. Them or others. He looked up at the blue sky of this late summer day. Somewhere in the distance, toward the Quabbin Reservoir, an eagle screamed. I think you can take that to the bank. But not today. Guys, Carla shouted. Lunch is ready. Henry took Noel from Jonesy. For a moment, Their hands touched. Their eyes touched. And their minds touched. For a moment, they saw the line. Henry smiled. Jonesy smiled back. Then they walked down the steps and across the lawn side by side, Jonesy limping, Henry with the sleeping child in his arms. And for that moment, the only darkness was their shadows trailing behind them on the grass.
Dreamcatcher was written by Stephen King and read by Jeffrey DeMott.